STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, dear friends, and welcome to Stand to Reason. So glad you joined me today. Greg Kokel is my name. I'm your host with you every week for 3 hours. And trusting that this afternoon we spend together, or whenever it is that you're listening, most listen on podcasts so you can choose your time, is going to be productive for you as well. Callers lining up here, so looking forward to having a chat with you in just a few moments. I just realized, and this is going to be painful to mention here, Christmas is in about 2 weeks. How is that possible? How is that possible? I don't know how it happens. You know, I look at December, and it's usually a slow month. It's always a slow month for me professionally. That is, I'm not running around the country. I'm largely home. I think I have only one event this month, and it's at my home church coming up this weekend. Sunday school class I get to teach. Glad to do it. I think to myself, gee, you'll have all of this time to get all these other things done. Oh, my goodness. It's like the month is one-third through already, and I've got a birthday coming up in a couple of days for my six-year-old, who will be seven. And we got Christmas, and two days later, we've got another birthday, my nine, who will be 10. We got all kinds of stuff going on, just like you guys, I know. But where does the time go? So I thought I'd talk a little bit about Christmas, some practical considerations, and I mention these things on a fairly regular basis. That is, every Christmas I'll mention it. I find that sometimes I'm a little late in getting it out because the first thing that I want to tell you about has to do with Christmas cards, and I'm going to talk a little bit about gift buying, and then I'm going to suggest some books, and then I'm going to take your calls. I got a buying tip, too, that you'll love, that everybody can benefit from. So the first thing is Christmas cards, and this might be a little bit late for some of you, I understand. But the first thing about Christmas cards is send them and say something about Jesus, for goodness sake. It is so frustrating for me when I get Christmas cards from people who love the Lord. I know they do. I know them. And their Christmas card says, Happy Holidays, or Season's Greetings. Goodness gracious. This is probably the one time in the year when all of your non-Christian friends expect you to say something about Jesus, and they're fine with it. They get it. So why don't you say something about Jesus in your cards? Now, in the past, and maybe we'll make this available now, in the next day or two, maybe Amy will post it on the blog tomorrow. In the past, I've provided a series of five or six different things that I have put on cards we've made in the past to, in a sublime way, draw attention to the significance of this event coming up. The national celebration of Christmas. It's a national holiday. Christmas is a national holiday. It's not Season's Greetings is the national holiday. And I know it's a bit overwhelming when you think about how the greetings have been transformed to this, you know, inconsequential, have a nice holiday type thing. I've almost given up on it. Not that I greet that way. I don't. In fact, I don't even say Merry Christmas because I want to say Happy Christmas. Some of you know that because it means the same thing, but it's said differently enough that people, I think, catch it, whatever. But I was encouraged last weekend as I was driving in Orange County and off the Garden Grove Freeway. So I was going eastbound. It's a big sign on the south side of the street, off to my right. I mean, a huge billboard. And it was Farmers and Merchants Bank. And I tip my hat to you because this big billboard had a picture, and this all it was three wise men on camels going across the desert and a big star placed above the entire thing. It wasn't on the billboard. It was above it with its own light. And they were moving towards the star, and it simply said in large letters, Merry Christmas. Oh, my goodness. Was that satisfying? It restored my faith in humanity in a small measure. And then that was on my way to an event. Coming back, I took the 5 north instead. And, man, there off to the side of the road was another big Merry Christmas. That was great. So it's the Merry Christmas is still kicking. Barely in our culture. So do what you can to keep that alive. Use your cards to say something meaningful about Jesus. The reason for the season wasn't giving. It isn't like God said, gee, this is a Christmas season. The reason for the season, giving and love. Okay, how can I give? Oh, I'll give my son. That's the present I'll give. No, that's the tail wagging the dog. The reason we give is because God first gave. He gave his son. So there's something that you can think about. And if you have not completed your Christmas card task yet and even purchased them, and many haven't, then there's a thought for you. And if you have, then make a note for next year. Say something meaningful about Jesus at Christmas in your card. Okay. Second, incidentally, my wife went to Disneyland last week with her girlfriends, had a great day off, was on It's a Small World. You all know what that is if you've ever been to Disneyland. It's kind of a must-see just because it's there. It's a kid's thing, but everybody goes there. And then you can't get that song out of your head for a couple of months. And there was Merry Christmas in Spanish. And there was Merry Christmas in Hawaiian. But where was Merry Christmas in English? She couldn't find it. What's up with that? Why can't they just say it in English? I don't know. And it's amazing how this Happy Holidays is sometimes really entrenched, because we went on Sunday after church to breakfast, and we went to a restaurant with my wife and two daughters that we go to frequently, and the manager there, or one of the head people, the hostess, has been there for a long time and recognized us immediately, came over to our table, we're making small talk, and she goes, Happy Holidays. Okay, and we say, hey, you know us, it's Merry Christmas, a Merry Christmas to you. And she said, Happy Holidays. It's like we could not even cajole her into saying Merry Christmas, even though she knew who we were. Was she getting, like, going to get docked from her pay if she said Merry Christmas? I don't know. I don't make a fuss about it anymore. If somebody says Happy Holidays to me, I say Merry Christmas. And usually they say Merry Christmas back, or I say Happy Christmas is what I actually say. So maybe that's something you could think about doing as well. Let's see. Christmas cards. Okay, this is very cool. I discovered this last year or the year before. It is called Amazon Prime. If you don't know about this, you need to know it. And indeed, if you use the Amazon Smile with your Amazon Prime, that means money can go to Stand to Reason as well. Okay, Amazon Prime is something you sign up for. And if you go to their homepage, it's very easy to find. Sign up for Amazon Prime. It costs something like $75 or $85 a year. But here's what you get with Amazon Prime. You get 2-day delivery on all Amazon Prime qualifying items, and that's like 80% of their stuff, and no shipping charges. So anything you order on Amazon Prime will be here in 2 days, no charges, no additional charges. You just pay that front fee. And I'll tell you, here's the greatest thing about it. You get a month for free. That means you can sign up now. It'll go to mid-January. You can cancel. You don't pay a dime. You get all your shipping free and in 2 days. That means you can take your Christmas list and do all your shopping in 1 hour. Set up one click for you, for yourself. Join Amazon Prime and then go click, 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 done. I mean, it's a no-brainer, all right? It's one of the best things I've ever discovered. And then if you want to go and sign up for Amazon Smile at the same time and designate Stand to Reason, well then, what, like a half a penny for every purchase goes to us. And they take care of all that. That's pretty cool. Okay, Amazon Prime. Last thing I want to mention here for Christmas is that oftentimes people want books that will help them in their spiritual life. And so maybe the last couple years, certainly last year, I don't know if I did it before that or not, I make a recommendation about a book set that is 5 books. There are dozens and dozens of books that I could recommend and have recommended in the past, but I'm thinking about a basic 5 of a foundational set of books for the Christian. A set of books that will give you a reference for doctrine, will give you something that will help you in apologetics, that will help you in your devotional life, that will help you to grow as a Christian, that will help you maneuver. What are the 5 categories here that I can recommend books to for? And that's what I put together. So let me just name them off, and then I'll give you a 6th one for your pastor. If you want to get him a book, this is what I'd recommend. Here's the first book. Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian conviction. I don't know who wrote that, but you can probably find it, sdr.org or Amazon. This is my number one recommendation. I'm sorry it sounds self-serving. I wrote the book. My apologies. But if anybody else wrote the book, I'd still say this is my number one recommendation because there's nothing like this that will allow you to maneuver effectively in conversations. I actually went back to the tactics book and I read the first couple pages just to see how do I get into my material? What do I promise the people? Does this sound appealing or engaging? The first page or two is really important, right? And I liked what I said there because I made promises I think I fulfill. I'll show you a more excellent way than what people are used to in engaging others on spiritual issues, which oftentimes is more shedding more heat than light. No, I want your engagements to look more like diplomacy than D-Day, and therefore that's why I recommend tactics, because I think that will give that to you. So enough said about that. Many of you know it. You already have it. But if you're going to help a new Christian out, or some believer has been around for a while but maybe doesn't understand this approach, there's what you get them, tactics. Second, I wanted a book that would help with one's spiritual growth, and so I recommend one that Justin Taylor recommended to me a number of years ago, and I was really glad to get it. It's a quick read, but it's very profound, and it's actually a reduction by an author of 2 ancient classics by John Owen, the great Puritan writer, on how to overcome sin in your life. Now, this reduction is simply titled The Enemy Within. The Enemy Within. And that would be you. The worst enemy you ever have to fight is yourself, okay? And the subtitle is Straight Talk About the Power and Defeat of Sin. Chris Lungard, Lungaard, is the author, Kris. Lungaard, and he has taken John Owen's work and reduced it so it is easy to read. Owen is difficult, and there are 2 volumes. This is a much smaller work that is the kind of thing you can read carefully 1 chapter at a time. Don't take more than 1 chapter, just 1 chapter. Although Justin Taylor told me he was so fascinated with it, he read it all in 1 sitting. And you may find that's true as well. But this is one you want to understand and begin applying to your life. It's excellent, The Enemy Within. A third is a basic apologetics book, and this is hard to decide on because there are so many good basic apologetics books out there. But I'm going to recommend Frank Turek's and Norm Geisler's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It covers all the really important bases in a way that's fairly easy to follow and understand, no difficulty there, and they are sensitive to the tactical elements. Frank is a good friend of mine. I've known Norm for many years, too. I just think this is a fabulous one-volume book. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. For your devotional life, I do not recommend the standard devotions that pluck a verse out of context and say something nice about it and maybe give you the right sermon with the wrong text. It really is frustrating for me when this happens. Even good people who ought to know better abuse texts. What I'm going to recommend for you is a small compilation of Puritan prayers. People like John Owen and the classic godly Puritan people. Spurgeon, for example, maybe arguably the last of the great Puritans. But there are all these prayers. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and they're just 2 pages long. 2 pages in a very small little handbook. I mean, you could read the whole prayer in, 3 minutes? And I find each of these prayers to be something that helps me to engage God in a sound fashion. And sometimes people are, if you're not from a liturgical tradition, maybe a little uncomfortable with praying somebody else's prayer. There's nothing wrong with praying someone else's prayer if it reflects the sentiments of your own heart. Make it your own. Pray through it carefully. And if the line of the prayer suggests some other thoughts, like, boy, Lord, I'm not good at this, then you pray that too. Just let it be a springboard. And I find that when I start time with the Lord with a page, a prayer out of Valley of Vision is the name of this book. Valley of Vision. And there's a leather bound that I have. You can get it in soft bound. I have a little leather bound copy or a faux leather bound, whatever. But I take it with me on trips. It's a great way to start one's time with the Lord. Finally, you need a compendium of theology. That is one volume that will give you a good survey of theological issues. So it's like a systematic theology, that it covers all the basic areas: Jesus, God proper, the Holy Spirit, salvation, last things, sin, devil, all kinds of stuff like that. And here I recommend a kind of a middle-of-the-road treatment where you're going to get a couple different opinions plus then the authors, but it gives you a bit of a survey. The book on Christian theology that I recommend is simply titled Christian Theology by Millard Erickson. Christian Theology, Millard Erickson. And you don't start at the beginning and go to the end. You use it as a reference or a resource. But it's the single best resource that I can recommend in that category. So what I've offered for a book set here, either individually or as a group for a new Christian: Tactics, The Enemy Within, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, Valley of Vision, and Christian Theology. One last thing I'd recommend for pastors is something I've mentioned in the past, I still think is going to be really important for the near future. This is a historical work of sorts. It's simply titled Preaching in Hitler's Shadow, subtitled Sermons of the Resistance in the Third Reich. And what Dean Stroud, the author, has done is he's written a 70-page introduction and then just included a series of sermons preached by Christian pastors from 1933 to 1945 in Germany during that difficult time. And what I hope this will do is help Christian pastors be emboldened to stand tall and to stand true. And I think it's a good gift for any pastor, and indeed, I just ordered mine on Amazon Prime and Amazon Smile for my pastor to give him this book in a couple of weeks. So there you have my recommendations for Christmas. They're kind of practical, but spiritual as well. Maybe the last thing that I could mention is if you've had a good year with us, we'd like to have a good year ending with you. I don't ask this very often, but we're here because of you. We're here for you and as a result of you. That is, we want to serve you. We want to build ambassadors for Christ. We want to instruct you. I want to mentor you, and many have told me that you do. But we also need your help to launch into next year, to finish out what we've got this year. And we always try to end in the black. That's the way we do business, but we need a big December in order to do that. If we have helped you in the past, you can go to str.org, hit the donate button. You'll just follow the prompts. But we need your prayers. We need your financial gifts. And if either is missing in any substance, we would be missing too. So please consider that this Christmas. Stand to reason. All right, friends, lots of people on the line here. Let me take a break, and I'll be back with you and your calls in just a moment. Stay with us.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. One thing I failed to mention in my standard Christmas lineup here is every year my family, for the last, I'd say, almost 10 years now, has been going to a fabulous concert, Christmas concert, at Grace Community Church in San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles area. Of course, many of you will not be able to go to this concert because you don't live in L.A., but if you're in L.A., I highly encourage you. This is John MacArthur's church, and there's just nothing like this concert. That's it. It's all I can tell you. It's you've got to go. It's very standard, very conventional, but the music is without parallel in terms of the quality of performers, and it's just something we do every year, and I want to commend it to you. You can go to gracechurch.org to get the details if you want. There are performances on Thursday, December 18th, Friday, December 19th, two on Saturday, December 20th, and one on Sunday, the 21st. Now, the tickets are all used up. They don't cost anything. But they're all used up. All the tickets, allow you to do is to get in early. But at 15 minutes before the event, and you should get there at least a half hour before, at least a half hour. I mean, there's just parking problems and all that. And a lot of times it's raining. For some reason, it rains on the day we go. But you want to get there early enough. But at a quarter till, 15 minutes before the event, they open the doors and anybody can come in and take whatever seats are left. And there are always seats left. Even if they're off to the side or back in the back, you can always find seats. And so I just, if you're in striking distance in Southern California on either Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, December 18th through 21st, and go to gracechurch.org for the details, then I encourage you to consider making this a family tradition yourself. All right? Okay, having done that, said that, let's go to our first caller in Coos Bay, Oregon, Clark. Hello, Clark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing fine, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. I don't know if they gave you a rundown of what I was going to ask, but it involves the problem of evil. And an article that I was reading was approaching the free will defense from both the Armenian and Reformed position.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am kind of middle of the road on those two.
That means you're undecided, right?
Right. It's I can see the merits of both positions in various forms, but I have yet to been able to really commit myself to the full doctrine of either side.
I understand.
But what struck me was I'd never heard this problem that was posed on the Reformed position before. He had stated that the free will defense is invalid because, according to it, a moral agent must have the ability to choose good or evil to be considered a moral agent. If that's the case, then God himself is not a moral agent because he does not choose, cannot choose evil, and therefore it could not be the source of morality.
Mm-hmm. That's called the CD.
Now, I don't believe that you necessarily have to have the choice between good and evil to be a moral agent, but I was curious as to your position on that.
Well, I've actually not heard it put precisely the way you just put it, but so let me come in from my direction. I do not think God has moral freedom in the sense of libertarian freedom, which has as one of its requirements the CDO condition or the could have done otherwise condition. Many people have characterized morality, let me back up. Libertarian freedom is freedom in which one makes the choice they want to make, and they could have done otherwise. They could have made another choice. It isn't just that you make the choice you want to make, but rather you could have done otherwise, and you had the power to do otherwise. Now, I do not think that condition applies to God.
Okay.
I mean, it just seems obvious. God cannot sin, period. But that's not a limitation. It's a virtue. It's a strength. He is capable of always doing good because his nature is good. He acts consistently with his nature and therefore never does wrong. Now, is he a moral agent? And it strikes me that he is a moral agent, that he is making moral choices, and it could be that he had done otherwise in a certain sense regarding his moral choices. He could have saved you and me instead of just you and not me.
Okay.
But it's not the case that he could have done otherwise in the sense that he could have done a good thing. He chose a good thing, but he could have done a bad thing. So
okay.
God has libertarian freedom, but his freedom is, the range of his freedom is restricted to his good character. He cannot choose outside of his character. And in my thinking, this does not make him any less of a moral agent. He is still the operating agent of the decisions that he makes. It's just that all of the decisions, whichever decisions he makes, are good by nature.
Uh-huh.
They are free in that they are God's choices, and there are times when he could have done otherwise. He did not have to save human beings. He chose to as an expression of goodness, but had he not, he still would have been good. He did not save the angels who rebelled. He had no obligation to do that. So in a certain sense, by choosing to save rebellious human beings, he went above and beyond the call of duty. So I guess certainly there is a sense in which God could have chosen other things, but what he could not have done is he could not have sinned. And sometimes people argue for the fall the requirement of the fall, or at least the logical possibility, because unless man was capable of sinning, his freedom wouldn't be real freedom. And my response is, well, then God doesn't have freedom because he isn't capable of sinning. So something
right.
must be wrong with that equation.
So in your view, then, would you say the free will defense, probably as it's most commonly presented, kind of like what you just said there, that mankind has to have the free will to choose, is and a result of that is evil or sin in the world? Would you reject that standard response for maybe a more modified answer, or would you just kind of more or less oppose using the free will defense in an argument?
Yeah, if humans are to have moral freedom, I think in this... I'm weighing my words carefully here. That's why I'm pausing.
Sure.
Because actually in this phone call, and this happens with some regularity, it's a good thing, I realized something I hadn't realized in prior conversations, that even though God doesn't satisfy the CDO condition with regards to good versus evil actions, he does satisfy it with regards to one good action versus another good action. So there's some things that satisfy that condition, but not others. God can't do evil. Now, why is it that human beings were given the opportunity to do evil? And I've always said, well, that a moral freedom requires that. And it's, I think certainly a certain kind of moral freedom does require that. Another kind of moral freedom doesn't, I guess, is the way I'd qualify it now. God made human beings with the kind of moral freedom that allowed them to choose evil and rather than good. Now, why did he do that? Some people have said, well, this demonstrates that we must love God as an act of our freedom and not being forced to love him. I don't think that works. I don't think it works because nobody loves as an act of freedom. We didn't marry our wives, or wives didn't marry their husbands. We don't love our children, et cetera, as an act of freedom. It's something that overtakes us. We don't freely choose to love. And here I'm not talking about when you're mad at them and you choose to act loving. I mean, the core of the love inside of us is not a choice. So I don't think that's that's the reason that God gave us moral freedom. I think that moral freedom was given because the exercise of moral freedom, which entails the could have done otherwise condition, in the case of Adam at least, he could have obeyed and he could not, and he might, but he could rebel. This state in human beings provides an atmosphere or a circumstance in which the soul can develop in unique ways that it would not be able to develop otherwise. And this is certainly true in a fallen world. So I guess what I want to say now is that God created the world in such a way that at least the first representative human being could have done otherwise with regards to sin, and that was a feature of their moral freedom. So it turns out he used his freedom poorly, and as a result, that limited the ability of humans to make choices. Humans can still choose between good and evil, but ultimately it is not the case that they can choose not to sin. They are born into sin, their natures are broken and fallen, and consequently they are slave to their nature, their fleshly nature, and also slave to the devil, who they chose to follow rather than God there in the garden. And so in virtue of these two slaveries, man has a much truncated ability to make choices. He can offer a certain liberty to do good, but it's modest, and it is not enough to rescue him from his problem. So that's probably the way I'd want to say it.
Okay. With that, and I don't want to take too much time away from any other caller, so I'll just keep this short. The one issue that comes back for me always with this position, with the reform position, and it's not something I necessarily disagree with. I think you can fairly easily see the sin nature of man just by turning on the television.
Sure.
But
having kids.
We have, with the idea of this of the limited free will, if I can call it that, or the freedom to do what your will is designed to, for mankind would be to sin prior to regeneration.
Yeah, wait, back up for a second. You mean the freedom to do what God originally intended the will to do? Is that what you mean, or for?
No, what I would say, what I mean, I'm just trying to say this properly.
Okay.
Mankind's free, in a sense, the free will, quote unquote, that man has without being regenerate would be simply the freedom to sin, because their will is corrupted.
Yes, there isn't the freedom never to sin. There is the freedom to make some choices, that which choice is to choose the good rather than the bad. But ultimately, because man is fallen, he is in rebellion against God, and that attitude of rebellion is itself culpable, it's blameworthy, and it leads to actions that reflect it, which themselves are individually culpable. So man's in a nasty spot. He, it is not possible for him not to sin completely, though there are some sins and some times he can say no to. Even so, the attitude of his heart is a rebellious attitude towards the God who's there. So
okay.
Now this, by the way, is not the Reformed position. It is the Christian position. That is, Arminians hold to this too. And any deviation from what I just described is not Christianity. It may be Pelagianism. Pelagius was a 4th-century heretic. But both Arminians and Calvinists, or Reformed thinkers on this, all agree about the nature of the fall, and that human beings are now fallen and under sin at birth. They have a sin nature that they are born with.
Sure.
So that isn't just a problem for Reform. That is a problem for Arminians as well. Now, what the Arminians want to say is that, well, there's a prevenient grace that kind of cancels that out and kind of makes things even, and therefore the libertarian freedom is the thing that breaks the tie between God's prevenient grace and the effects of the fall. That's not my view, but that's the way it works in. But all have to acknowledge the results of the fall
on
human decision-making. Okay?
Okay.
Sound good?
I appreciate that.
All right, Clark, happy Christmas to you, sir.
You too. Real quick, tell Alan that I did call you, because I talked to him about this on Facebook, and he recommended that I call, so I did.
All right, I'll let him know. Thanks so much, Clark.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, bye. Appreciate that call. Let's go to break, and I'll come back in just a few moments on Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, friends. Let's see what we got here. Got a lot of callers still on board. Let's go to Neil. And is it Yakima, Washington, or Yakima? Neil?
That's Yakima.
Yakima. Isn't there a product made by Yakima, like the ski racks or something like that you put on your car? Is that Yakima?
Yakima bikes and ski racks. I don't know if they're based here or not, though.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, we got the name right now, Yakima. So what's on your mind, Neil?
Well, the enforcer kind of chuckled when I asked this question, so maybe she has some insight on this too. and you'll get it here in a second.
I'm
starting up my own little ministry, and I'm actually kind of modeling it after STR a little bit, but it's geared towards students, younger people.
Uh-huh.
And
good.
I'm naturally a people pleaser, and basically I'm struggling with maintaining humility as a leader and, you know, hopefully if things go well, maybe one day a Christian public figure whose goal it is to gain a larger audience. Like, how do you balance the humility with also the goal of, hey, my goal is to reach as many people as possible, and in doing so, you know, obviously pride is creeping in.
Yeah, I'm not sure if balance is the right word. I know what you're after here. So let me tell you, I'll just speak autobiographically here a little bit. I became a Christian in 1973, and in 1974, that was in the fall of 73, in spring of 1974, I moved in with a Christian community in Westwood Village right by the campus of UCLA, and I was there for 2.5 years. This particular Christian community had a series of former Campus Crusade instructors that were now training at this school called the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse, and one of those instructors was Hal Lindsey. Now, Hal at the time was the number one best-selling author of the entire decade of the 70s. That is, no one in the world, except for maybe the Apostle John, sold more books than Hal Lindsey did. Okay, now, whether people agree with this theology is not relevant, his lifestyle or anything like that, to my point. He was a person that had, in a lot of good ways, had a good impact on me, as well as a number of other teachers in that enterprise. But I, in the spring of 1976, I had lunch with him and asked him the exact same question. Okay, because here's a guy who, well, look at, you know, tremendous visibility, and so how do you deal with this? And here's what he told me. I think there's wisdom in this, and it may need to be qualified a little bit. But what he said was this. He said, what I have as my goal is to go out and serve the Lord effectively, and then I'm going to let God deal with my own pride problem as it comes. It doesn't mean that he was going to be vigilant. It does not mean that he was not going to be vigilant. This isn't the point he was making. He was saying that, I think he was telling me, don't set your focus on trying to be useful and productive. And if pride then rears its head as a problem, God has a way of dealing with that when you are a Christ-centered person, when you care about making a difference for Christ, okay? Now, so I felt this was good advice. It wasn't that, well, the pride will take care of itself or whatever, but God has a way of dealing with those things. Now, so what I ended up doing is something that I recommended many times here on the show, is blooming where I was planted. Very soon after I became a Christian, Neil, I really wanted to make a significant impact for the Lord. And I don't have any sense at the time that it was because of self-aggrandizement. I really had a genuine heart for the kingdom. However, that's always a temptation, as you're pointing out. And as time went on, and I got into the late 70s, especially as I look back now, I can see how there were problems for me in that way. And in fact, some people, I can think of things that I've said in the past and things that people reflected back to me, that this was getting to be a consideration. And I'm, you know, God dealt with me for 3 years. I'd say maybe 2.5 years. I went through a very, very difficult time in my life. And I will say, by the time 1982 came around, I went to Thailand, and by the time I got back at the end of 82, beginning of 83, there had been some changes in my life. Now, I'm not going to say I never struggled with that. That's not my point. But my point was that there had been some changes through the ordeal of the trials that I experienced during those 2.5 years or 3 years that had a salutary effect on that particular issue. And I began to view public life as a Christian leader of some sorts in a very different way. That relieved me of the burden of being completely self-consumed. Let's just put it that way. And again, I don't want to suggest that I don't struggle with that, but there's a difference now than it was then. That's all that's all you need to know. I mean, I don't know how else to characterize it. God worked on me. What Hal said would happen actually happened. Now, I was dedicated as a follower of Christ to making a difference. The most important thing that I think about my own life is that I want to finish the course, and when I do, hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." That's what I want to hear. That's what my life is about. That's the most important thing in my life. Okay, everything else falls underneath that. However, I have a lot of public visibility, and this has its temptations. And so this is why I need to have people around me that have the liberty and the freedom to keep me in check. And this I've given to my staff. I've told them. I've told friends. Melinda doesn't need to be told. She's going to keep me in check anyway as a friend, you know. So I have people in my life that help me here that can give me feedback. And I would say that they would characterize me as a teachable person. Again, this isn't to draw a lot of attention to myself. It's just to help answer your question, but autobiographically. So I got just as many troubles and difficulties as anybody else, and I never want to suggest that other people's spiritual lives should be like mine, because I know what the inside's like, and it's not a pretty picture. I understand grace, which is another thing that I learned from Hal Lindsey. I had a very, very strong foundation in the doctrine of grace. So this has been helpful. I am leery of the liabilities of being in the limelight, and I think this is something that I learned a long time ago to be leery of by the grace of God. So in your case, I the only thing I could tell you really is I think the sound advice that was passed on to me. Make your goal to pursue productivity as an ambassador for Christ, as a Christian worker. You know, try to make your life count for Christ. And if God gives you the kind of success in that endeavor that tempts your pride, if you are a person of surrender and submission to Christ, and this is your general attitude, and you're cultivating a teachable attitude, and you're cultivating a willingness to hear others and even given others permission to weigh in about what they see as liabilities in your life, then I think you can just let God take over from there. Because if you have an openness like that and a willingness like that, then I think God will honor that. And as the temptations for wrong thinking arise, he will begin to work on them. I have these thoughts all the time in my mind. They just constantly come in my mind, just like anybody's, you know. And I recognize them for what they are, apologize before the Lord, and move on. I'm under grace. I'm not devastated by it. I see it. Okay, that's me, God. But I'm gonna confess it right then and move on. I'm going to keep that constant awareness that thoughts like that are inappropriate, and ask God to help me be aware when I'm trying to, when I am self-aggrandizing in more skillful and subtle ways nowadays. I mean, there are ways you learn to be draw attention to yourself that aren't as obvious as they used to be, but they're still wrong. You just get more clever at it. And this is something that the Spirit will deal with, too, if you're open to it.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Greg.
Yeah, and I hope God does prosper your work. You know, faithful in small things, he'll give you bigger things. And those demands that bigger things require, make on you, then as you're walking with the Lord, then he is going to I think, enable you to manage that. It's not always, it's not going to be fun. I'm just telling you. You stand up in, here, look at, let me just, somebody quoted this to me or offered me this quote, and I'll leave it with you, a couple of weeks ago, that people who have visible blessings, this is a Spurgeon, a paraphrase of a Spurgeon comment, people with great visible blessings carry great invisible crosses. That is, in their private life somewhere, somehow, there is difficulty and hardship and suffering that most people are never aware of. And it goes hand in hand. All right?
All right. Well, thank you, Greg. I do appreciate it.
All right, Neil.
And hopefully I didn't get the enforcer in trouble.
No, not at all. I'm glad for your ambition in the Lord. It is a good thing to be ambitious in the Lord. It is a good thing. Even coming to me with your request for help or counselor, whatever it is, is a sign of a heart that's in the right place regarding these issues. So if you continue in that attitude, and are you married?
Yes.
Yeah, well, wives have a way of keeping us feet on the ground, and so do kids. And do you have children?
No kids.
Okay. So this might be something you'd want to mention to your wife. Help me in this. I'm struggling here a little bit. As things prosper, I'm glad for it. But then I start, believing my own press. Somebody once said, I've heard different variations of this, but it amounted to if people can see what I was thinking just in one day, the thoughts that go through my mind in one day, they would run me out of town, And I suspect everybody who's listening to this, who is a Christian, not non-Christians, because I don't think non-Christians have an accurate understanding of their fallenness. But Christians, by definition, because they are people who have acknowledged their need. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus said. Those who have understand their spiritual poverty, like the person, not like the Pharisee at the front of the synagogue saying, gee, look at all the stuff, how wonderful I am, I tithe, I this, I that. But like the tax collector in the back of the synagogue who wouldn't raise his head, his eyes to heaven, but his head is bowed and he's beating his breast and saying, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's the person who goes away justified. When we have, I've kind of lost my train of thought now, but I think I was going to say, when we have that perspective in general, I know what I was going to say. We all, as followers of Christ, as Christians, we have had a moment like that because we've seen our need and we said, God, help me. So if you're a Christian, you know how bad you are. And the better the more you're aware of your badness, the healthier it is for you as a Christian. And this is an interesting little thing that I have observed myself, but I think I see it maybe even in the writings of Paul, that the more you grow in the Lord, where are my glasses? The more you grow in the Lord, the more you're aware of your own fallenness. And Paul's first letter was Galatians. And if you go to Galatians and read the first chapter of Galatians, there Paul is talking about himself as an apostle, not sent from men, nor through the agency of men, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead. And I did not consult with flesh and blood, but I went away and this and that and the other thing. And all these things are true things that happened, but he's leading with himself quite a bit in this book, okay? If you go to 1 Timothy, much later in his life, he says, I am the least of the apostles. I am the greatest of sinners. So here he is towards the end of his life, it seems to me, having a much deeper sense and awareness of his own sin. And I think this is true in Christians' lives who are healthy. This doesn't mean they're morose or they have a false sense of humility or they got to keep thrashing themselves. I don't thrash myself. I know that I am made in the image of God and loved of God, and I'm rescued by his grace. I'm safe in him. But I also know that it is in him that I'm safe, not in myself, because I am well aware of my own liabilities. And so being continuing to be mindful of those things, I think, has helped me to maintain, to use your word, balance. I am mindful of not taking my own press seriously, okay? And, okay, you say that nice thing about me. All right, I accept that. I appreciate that kind of thing. Let another praise you and not your own lips. So don't go, you know, shooting off about your own virtues. But let other people do that. If somebody wants to say something nice, then you just say thank you. You know, be gracious. It's a very simple way. It doesn't mean you're prideful. You just let another praise you. So people say nice things. I say thank you. It's just that simple. But I also know there's another side to me they don't see. I'm glad for the good things God has done, but man, there's a whole bunch of other that's in process. And in fact, last week I was thinking, gee, 41 years a Christian, and I'm still struggling with this. In fact, today I'm praying. I have been praying for the last 6 years for three spiritual fruits: patience, gentleness, and self-control. Now, the three ones I picked out of that list in Galatians, and I'm praying for these things: patience, gentleness, self-control, towards my wife, towards my girls. Patience, gentleness, self-control. And I'm praying this morning coming into the office, man, I have not made any progress at all in all these years of praying on that. So this is all just to let you in a little bit that I'm aware to a great degree, probably not as aware as I should be, of my own liabilities. I understand that. It's good that I'm aware of them because it helps me keep my own thoughts about myself accurate. I'm deeply fallen and flawed, and yet God still uses me. And if God can use me, then he can use anybody. That's my thinking.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Greg. I do appreciate it, and I'll keep all this in mind as I grow.
All right, Neil, God's best to you.
All right, you too, Greg. God bless.
Bye-bye. I think I said God's blessed to you. Well, that's kind of a combination of God's best and God bless you. That's right. This particular thing that I was just talking about, and I have to just admit to you, I felt a little uncomfortable talking about myself in that regard but since the question was what it was, I thought being autobiographical was helpful. I don't want to draw that kind of attention to myself. I already get more attention than I deserve and more attention than is good for me, okay? But I do want you to see some things that are there that are important for your own life. That's it for this hour, friends. Plenty to come, so stay with us and stand to reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And here we are just 2.5 weeks from Christmas. And my daughters and I, with my wife last night, lit our first Advent candle. You're thinking that's 2 weeks late. And my response is, you got kids? You got a job? Lots of things are late, right? So I'm going to tell you in the next 4 minutes what happened last evening, then get to your calls. And I want to tell you, largely to encourage you as parents, if you are parents, with regards to your children, because the temptation is to think that Kokel's got it all together there, and he's got this system, and everything's working smoothly, and that's why his kids are so wonderful. Which, my kids are pretty good, but, you know, there are limits to that, too. They're kids. And what you may not know is that almost every single time that we've tried to get together or I've tried to initiate something with the Bible and my family, it's turned into a disaster. Well, maybe that's my fault. I don't know. Maybe it's the devil. I don't know. And the ideal thing around Advent is like 4 weeks before, you have this perfect Advent reflection with your children that are in rapt attention, and they light the candle and everybody prays, and they have this wonderful experience with God and with mom and dad in Advent. Well, here we are, 2.5 weeks from Christmas. We haven't lit a candle yet. That's because we've been running around like everybody else trying to make sense of the world, getting everything taken care of that we have to take care of right now and that's pressing upon our lives. And we meant to do it a couple nights ago, and something else came up. And plus, what am I going to talk about? I don't have, like, the perfect Advent thing. I got a couple of things, but most of us have booklets from something. You can find it on the internet. But you know what I realized? The most important thing is just do something. And it better not be too long, because kids don't have a long attention span. Now, my 9 is better than my 6 in this regard. But still, and if you want to do something with them, include them. So I told them, we're going to have a little Advent reflection tonight, later on. So bring your Bibles, and you get to participate. So they got their Bibles, and they get to read. And so my 6-year-old was able to read a couple of verses, and then we talked a little bit, and my 9-year-old read some, and we talked a little bit. So what did I read? Well, I thought, this is the Advent, God coming to earth in the person of Jesus. So I said, well, let's just start at the beginning of Jesus' story in the Gospel of John, John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We actually read the first 5 verses, and then we dropped the couple of verses that had to do with John the Baptist, and then verse 9, we picked it up there, and we took it down to verse 14. And verse 14 is the verse that I think is the most significant verse in the Bible, even more important than Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, because that's pretty cool, a God of power and might that can produce the whole universe. But the God who becomes a man, that is sublime. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So that's where we ended last night. But as we went through these passages, I would just ask some questions. So when my 6-year-old read the first 3 verses about the beginning of was the Word was with God, He was God, and He created everything, I asked, what does that remind you of, those words, in the beginning? Oh, yeah, that's from the beginning of the Bible. In the beginning, God created light, Eva said, the 6-year-old. I said, well, kind of, yeah. The same one who was in that beginning is here in this beginning, the Word who becomes flesh. That's what I wanted them to get. And so we just talked around that a little bit, and they gave their own thoughts and stuff, and then I guided it a little bit. It wasn't clever. It wasn't profound. It was just some stuff working through the text. And then I made as many, he came to his own, but those who were his own did not receive him, but as many as did receive him, to them he gave the power to become children of God. And so we talked a little bit about that, and we got to our verse 14, and we talked a little bit about that. I asked them some questions. Sometimes they got the right answers, sometimes they didn't. It did not matter. What matters is that Papa was leading them through a text that had to do with God coming to earth and interacting with them in a way that they could participate in. They did some of the reading. They did the reading. They did some answering questions, and then we were done, and then we blew out the candle and we moved on. So this kind of thing does not have to be a huge production, dads, moms. It could just be something fairly simple. Just make sure you do something, you say something, you involve them in the process, both reading and talking. Ask questions. And then leave with a little summary statement. It was that God who created everything in the very beginning that became a man and that little baby whose birthday we celebrate on Christmas. There you go. Now, next time, since we're a little behind, probably in four more days, we'll try to get the second candle lit. And I think I'm going to talk about the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, and just talk about that, how God established a rescue plan to rescue the world by calling one man whose name was Abram, and then promising to build a nation from him that he would protect and would prosper to the end, that all the nations of the earth will be blessed in him. Those are the Jews. And how would the nations be blessed, kids? Through Jesus. There you go. So I'm going to try to make that connection, because when we get further on in some of the birth narratives, you have this reference to our forefathers and a promise to Abraham. And so Son of God language, and I want these two passages, the John passage and the Genesis passage, to be there kind of back in their minds to be drawing from when we get to these to the birth narratives. So I just mentioned this because I'm stumbling my way through this like you are probably, and it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be clean. It doesn't have to be tidy. It just needs to be something that is spiritual with you and your family, that is substantive, that is foundational regarding Christmas. Bring them back to the text. Do something. And then let the Holy Spirit do the rest. That's my recommendation. Okay, having said that, let us go. Oh, this looks so in a sense, odd to me, but I'll tell you why. This is Frank in Illinois. Frank, welcome to the show. Frank?
Hello.
Yes, is this Frank?
Frank?
Yes. Frank?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, let me tell you why this is odd for me, because I'm from Illinois, and my dad's name was Frank. And so when I see Frank, Illinois, I think, oh my goodness, my dad's calling me. There's a little shiver went through my spine. Did I do something bad? You know, that kind of thing.
I almost got you. Oh, well, if it was April Fool's, it would have been funny.
Well, glad to have you on board, Frank.
Thank you for having me. This is actually the first time I've done this. I would like to make a disclaimer. I have listened to, you know, you and the other guys on Stand the Reason a few times. I got the little app. That's how I found out about this little broadcast.
Great.
And most of the times, most of the time, I appreciate what, you guys have to say, what you guys have to say.
It's good.
And I do like your demeanor. I do like, some of the things that you suggested as far as like when evangelizing to other people and things like that. The reminders. With that said, I was just going to listen, just, you know, feed off you. But the first caller was talking to you about freedom and free will and things of, you know, the Calvinist predestination, Arminian, all that other stuff.
As it turned out, we didn't get into too much about Calvinism versus Arminianism. The discussion about freedom was pretty basic to broad Christian theology. That particular discussion was.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like I just wanted to know a few things because it seemed like the definition of, I guess, freedom. Was kind of being reinterpreted to support, like, a justification as far as like philosophically and rationally for like a Calvinistic interpretation of scripture.
The definition of freedom I gave is the definition of freedom that I got from William Lane Craig, who is definitely not a Calvinist.
Right.
Okay. So the idea of freedom can be characterized in two ways generally. That is, it can be characterized as libertarian freedom, which could have done otherwise, characteristic to it, and it also can be characterized in a way that is referred to as soft determinism, and that is simply that a person does what he wants or she wants, and that's the only requirement necessary for freedom. If you're doing what you want, that's adequate, but the wants themselves can be determined by something else on that view. Now, I don't hold to that view. I'm largely libertarian, but I want to give a qualification with regards to the sin and fallenness issue. I didn't make that qualification in that call, but the way that I defined freedom, those two categories, is a classical definition.
Mm-hmm. So now, in order for someone to believe, I'm not an Arminian, I'm definitely not a Calvinist. In order for someone to accept the free will, the conversation was basically saying that in order for someone to accept free will, or while also understanding the problem of our fallen nature,
uh-huh,
then you have to accept a libertarian. Not a libertarian. It was the other one that you were.
Yeah, what I was saying simply is that if after the fall our freedom is hampered, so that even though we can make choices that satisfy the CDO condition, could have done otherwise condition, in many ways that would be libertarian freedom, there are limits to that. We cannot make choices that keep us ultimately from being sinners. It is not the case. How does the Latin go? It says passe, no, non passe. It's not possible not to sin. That's the classical non passe non peccari is the Latin phrase that means not possible not to sin, and that is the circumstance for fallen people according to classical Christianity, regardless of your view of salvation, Arminian or Calvinist. So I'm not saying anything new there. It is not possible not to sin. If what you're asking for is a freedom in which the CDO condition can be satisfied across the board, that we can choose, we are capable of consistently choosing good as humans, this regardless of whether, I'm not talking about whether Christians now regenerate are capable. That's a different discussion. Just in general, are fallen humans capable of doing that? The answer is no. And that is
no.
Basic Christian
doctrine. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, that is basic Christian doctrine. That's not just Calvinist doctrine or Reformed doctrine.
Right. Right. No, yeah. I definitely don't believe that Christians are, humans, apart from having a relationship with Christ, are capable of being, even on this life, I don't think that Christians, after having a relationship with Christ, are capable of being perfect. I don't think that
comes
up.
Yes, I agree with you there. There are some denominations who teach otherwise, but I agree with you there. So it sounds like we're on the same page, Frank.
Yeah.
My dad agrees with me.
My
dad agrees with me, finally.
I did not know I had a kid. That's not okay.
Probably a kid that's older than you. That would be a trick, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so I do agree with that. I mean, I do agree that God could, if he so decided to do something that, as far as what he instilled in us as moral law, would be wrong, but I don't believe he would ever do that. I do believe his nature can still be perfectly good and always, and that we can trust him and know that he'll always
but
be good.
I don't understand that, though. If his nature is perfectly good and his actions go forth from his nature, the capability to do evil, the possibility, you said he's possible, but he would never choose that. Well, the possibility itself is a moral flaw, it seems to me. No, it's a moral flaw. If God possibly can do evil, that means he's morally flawed. He's not morally perfect. Moral perfection doesn't just mean that he doesn't do wrong from day to day. It means that he is fully, so thoroughly and completely good that nothing evil can flow from him. That's why it's impossible for God to lie. It is impossible for God to lie. That's in Hebrews 10. Because God's nature is such that such a moral imperfection is inconsistent with his nature. So I'm.
So do you believe?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was walking on you. I'm done. Your turn.
So do you believe that him? So you do believe that him being like him having the ability, like are you saying, like capability, like him having the ability versus possibility, like the chance of him doing it. So you don't. So because the way I was seeing it was more so of a, and this was just like a comment leading into this. Didn't really have anything to do with predestination versus free will or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that, because I was looking more of it as he has the capability to do whatever as far as, you know, power-wise, moral-wise, whatever, the possibility was zero.
Yes,
like
okay.
There's certain things that he just wouldn't do.
Yeah. Now,
he won't defy the logic that he instilled. He won't defy the morality that is intrinsic to his nature.
Right. You know? Okay. Well, let me answer that because I think I understand what's going on a little bit because others have said something similar. And the mistake here, I think, Frank, is that you begin to see the language you used was this, the ability. He has the ability. Well, being capable of sinning is not an ability. It is a disability. It is, we say, when we say that God can sin, in principle, he can. He won't, but he can. We are not identifying something that is a positive. It's a negative or a disability expressed in a positive way. So if I say I can make an error, I'm just expressing in a positive way a lack. That means I can't always do what's correct. Therefore, I can make an error. But when we say I can make an error, we're not identifying an ability, but a lack of an ability. So whenever we say God is able to sin or able to do evil in principle, we are confessing a disability he actually has, and that's not something I think is true of him. That's why I say God is never capable of a sin, because that would be meaning he'd be capable of a lack, something missing, something, a problem, and he's not capable of that. God is capable, and in fact always does, what is good. He is not capable of failing, and sin would be a kind of failure. So it's when we say he's able to sin, we're identifying a lack of an ability rather than an ability. And the language, I think, sometimes turns us around.
No, that actually makes a lot of sense. I think I agree with that.
Good.
that does make a lot of sense. It does. I think I was just looking at it the wrong way.
Yes, this happens a lot in this circumstance when we're talking about this very thing. I heard somebody that was very smart once say that God must be able to lie, because if he couldn't lie, that means I could do something that God couldn't do. And there you can see the mistake. He's looking at a negative as if it's a positive ability rather than the lack of ability to always tell the truth. So, all righty.
Well, that does make sense. I had already looked at sin in general as that way, like it's kind of, you know, I've heard other people say that it's kind of like, you know, the rust with the car. You know, you can have a car without rust, but you can't have rust without the car.
Yeah, okay.
But I guess I'd never applied that to God. I guess I just didn't go all the way with that. Does that make sense?
There you go. All right, Frank, from Illinois. Boy, this is really weird, but it's nice talking to you, Frank.
All right, you have a good one.
All right, I appreciate the call. I looked up and saw Frank, Illinois, and I thought of my dad. That went better than the conversations with my dad often went. All right. How about Nick in Georgia? Let me find you, Nick. Here we go. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
As always, thank you and your team for everything you guys do.
You're very welcome, as always.
Wonderful. All right. So my question, as you already know from the prompt, is the ethical implications of torture. I put a good amount of thought into this, you know, done my own thought experiments. So I kind of want to just really quick set this up for you so you know where I'm going with it.
Okay.
I was a soldier for many years. I dealt with detainees. So it's very, hands-on. I mean, I'm
real.
Very aware of the issues.
Real, yeah.
Yeah. especially funny because I wanted to ask you this weeks ago, but then with all the political nonsense going on. So I'm not talking about just the kind of stuff that happened to John McCain or senseless torture just to happen, just because they look different or the things that ISIS is doing. I'm talking about, you know, control parameters. I'm talking about
enhanced techniques, kind of, right?
Yeah, exactly. Controlling the environment to instill fear and discomfort, but not cruelty. Now, I've heard a lot of usually from veterans, you know, I mean, just, you know, my circles, arguing, and they, a lot of times they'll use utilitarian logic or, you know, morality. And I mean, that's just unsustainable as far as I've conceived. But is it, I mean, you know, when I think about the image of God and I think about the dignity and respect that all human beings deserve, I'm having a hard time, you know, agreeing with my buddies, even though I know that the, you know, I mean, is enhanced interrogation, is that wrong? I mean, is that the bare bones of the question?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot going on here. I know this is in the news right now too. Part of the difficulty here, I think, is the language we use, and I'm glad that you shifted from torture language to enhanced interrogation, because I think the word torture is emotionally laden word. And I don't mean that we shouldn't be emotionally responding to the kind of treatment that, say, John McCain received when he was in the Hanoi Hilton for so many years. That, I think, would be our classical understanding of torture. Now, but when, because somebody experiences physical discomfort at some level during an interrogation, does that mean that they're undergoing the kind of treatment that qualifies morally for the term torture, a term that we would properly apply to what happened to John McCain? Look, I went into the bedroom the other night when the girls weren't obeying, and I was yelling at them. Now, my yelling probably wasn't appropriate at the moment, but nevertheless, I did it, okay? I'm just using this as an example. I told my daughters, they said, you don't want me to yell? Then don't do that again. So here I was introducing a discomfort in order to change their behavior, okay? So was I torturing them?
No, of course not.
Clearly the term would not apply, because torture seems to be a word that is applied to a certain kind of pain or level of pain with a certain intended purpose. Okay, so we understand that there are times when pain is applied appropriately and times when it is not applied appropriately. That's the only distinction that I'm making here. And we have to be careful when we're trying to figure out when it's appropriate, not inappropriate. With this word torture, I think, gets in the way. And this is what I think has happened in the discussion. George Bush authorized torture. Well, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Let's not so fast here. You know, enhanced interrogation, that isn't just a euphemism. That isn't a way of necessarily making real torture sound good. That is a way of trying to distinguish between immoral torture and a moral use of force and discomfort and even pain, or emotional pain or physical pain mixed in. And I think there is a place for that, because, you know, we use this in everyday relationships after a fashion.
Sure.
Okay. So then the question becomes where that line is. Now you used the term utilitarian logic, or phrase utilitarian logic, a moment ago. And utilitarian simply, it refers to an approach to moral decision making in which the end in view is the only morally relevant question. So since I'm trying to accomplish a good end, whatever means contributes to that end, then it's okay as long as it's contributing to the end. And this is where the phrase, the end justifies the means, comes in. Okay? In utilitarianism, depending on what end you had in mind, let's just say it's happiness. Whatever contributes to my happiness, since happiness is the goal, whatever gets me there, that's justified. Okay? Mm-hmm. Based on a utilitarian ethic. Now, I'm not a utilitarian, but there always is going to be a relationship between means and ends in a moral decision making, even for me. Sometimes the means is justified because of the end in view. Sometimes it isn't. There's a relationship, and I have to look at both. So I couldn't be accused of being a utilitarian because I don't think the end always justifies the means. But sometimes the end does and sometimes the end doesn't. So we just have to look at it. And this is what moral decision-making entails.
Okay. Sure. I guess I was having trouble because, you know, I hear oftentimes, you know, whatever I'm talking about, you know, whether it's abortion or, you know, I gave a talk on stem cells a while back.
Uh-huh.
I hear, you know, you get those kinds of arguments. Well, look at how many people we can save. It's like, well,
yes,
if we have to kill children,
right,
still not worth it.
That's right. That is an example of when you're looking at the end and the means, and though the end is a good end, the means are not, in this particular case, are not adequate to justify the end. Okay. Now, what about human necropsy? So you experiment. So you take dead bodies and you cut them up. And you use them mm-hmm. for experiments or something and say, well, they're dead. Well, there's a sense, one could argue, that human bodies ought to be respected because of the human being who is valuable that once inhabited that body. This is the thinking behind the phrase Christian burial. Let's give them a Christian burial. That is, let's give this corpse the kind of treatment that shows due respect for the valuable human being that this corpse used to be.
Sure.
And that's in light of a Christian worldview, okay? So there is a, you know, let's not mutilate it. Some people are against cremation for that reason, okay? Now, but then we say, well, wait a minute. There is a case in which if we do mutilate it by using the body for science, some good could come of it that trumps the concern of how you treat the body. And I think in this case, the end does justify the means. The end is so good that it trumps the good of not mutilating the body under other circumstances. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's, you make that decision. In the case of if you're going to kill a human being to help another human being like that,
yeah,
let's kill this person, take his liver, take his kidneys, take his heart, 1, 2, 3, 4. We sacrifice one life to save four lives. We're ahead three lives. Well,
sure.
If you were utilitarian, that would be okay.
Yeah.
But in this case, the end doesn't justify the end does not justify those means. So we're just talking theoretically now about how these kinds of decisions are made, but we haven't addressed the specific issue of enhanced techniques.
Sure. So I've always operated. I don't know. After studying philosophy and theology, I always, I guess, operated maybe under the false assumption that we always operated off either divine command theory or deontological ethics. So, but you're saying that there's, you know, there is times when I guess there has to be the use of utilitarian logic or morality. And I guess the follow-up question would be, is do we use a sort of moral hierarchy, which I think I've heard you subscribe to. Murder is worse than theft and whatever it may be.
Right, right, right. I do subscribe to that. I think it's biblical, and that is
my
view. So I wasn't, what I mentioned before about utilitarian elements coming into our decision-making, this doesn't necessarily void divine command or deontological ethics, deontological being mm-hmm. a Kantian ethic, for those who are not familiar, which that relates to duty. We do things for duty's sake, you know, whether we like it or not, we do it because it's our duty to do those things. There's more to it than that. But sometimes to determine our duty, we have to look at a relationship of means to ends. So the utilitarian equation comes in there. It's just not the case that the ends always justify the means. That would be utilitarian ethics. So given our duties based on commands that God gives us, then I have to make a decision in any given situation which duty applies. And there, that's where your hierarchy comes in. I have a duty to tell, because of divine command, if you will, so there's an integration there, it can be. And I have a duty not to deceive or tell a lie. I also have a duty to protect human lives. Now, what happens when I could either deceive or lie or surrender innocent human life? I'm between a rock and a hard place. I have one of two decisions. Both in isolation would be wrong. What do I do?
Yeah.
Well, I do the greater good. I protect the human life, and I deceive to do so. And in deceiving, I'm not doing wrong. I'm doing right. So what one has to decide then when it comes to an issue of enhanced interrogation.
Yeah, enhanced interrogation techniques.
One has to are those right? It depends. It depends is what my answer is going to be. I'm presuming, first of all, that the enhanced interrogation is not done for the purpose of bringing pleasure to the person who is doing the interrogation, and that it is not senseless. It's not done for the purpose of just simply inflicting pain on an enemy. That would be torture. You do it for the pleasure that it brings you, which is sadistic, and you do it just for that purpose. There's no end in it whatsoever, except for the pain it causes. That's what torture, to me, is quintessentially. Now, are there times when causing pain, which you would not normally do on with a creature made, a human being made in the image of God, is morally not just allowed, but it's obligatory? Yes, I think that's the answer. It depends what's at stake. And I think this is where, you know, watching 24, you get a lot of examples of that. I remember the second season of 24. This is the one where somebody, there was an atomic bomb going to blow up in Los Angeles. And some of the things that Jack had to do in order to find out where that bomb was at so that everybody wouldn't die. He said to his boss at one point, he says, the problem with you is you want to solve this, but you don't want to get your hands dirty. You don't want to do the hard things that are necessary in order to get the job, the morally correct job done. Look, if we don't find this bomb, everybody in the city is going to die. So therefore, if some people have to die in the process of finding the bomb, then you've got a net benefit. We are saving lives, you know. So I'm not suggesting that these are always easy decisions to make.
Sure,
these are the decisions that people like you in your former profession have to make. I remember thinking, but the military, you know, the Civil War, we lost at Fredericksburg. We lost brutally. When I say we, I mean the North. The Union lost brutally. The South won, and Lincoln reasoned that if we can lose four more battles just like we lost at Fredericksburg, then the Union would win the war. Because both the North and the South lost lots of men at that battle. The North lost more, but the North could lose more. If the South kept winning battles by losing that many people, they'd be done for. And he called that the bloody arithmetic. And he searched in vain for a long time to find a leader that understood the bloody arithmetic. And when he found Grant, he finally found a general that could lead his army that could win the war. And he did. But notice how you have, you know, in those kinds of situations, you have to commit yourself to doing otherwise evil things in order to accomplish the greater good. And that's what happened in that circumstance. I think the same kind of equation applies here, the same kind of equation, but that doesn't mean that it's always easy to decide in any given situation, and it doesn't mean that it is easy to carry out. And so this is a very unusual circumstance, and the military is a perfect example, and your role, as vital as it was, this is a very unusual circumstance in which doing the right thing often injures one's soul. Generally, it's the opposite. You do the right thing, it's good for your soul. You do the bad thing, it's bad for your soul. That isn't always the case in a fallen world. Sometimes doing the right thing in a fallen world results in one's soul being injured, and that's PTSD and things like it.
Greg, do you have any recommended maybe reading? Because, I mean, you've helped tremendously, but I still just, you know, have a hard time, you know, finding that line maybe. You know, it's okay to torture a terrorist to save L.A.? Is it okay to torture his daughter?
Well, see, this is why I don't think you should use the word torture, because once you the word torture, you've already de facto decided on the morality of the act.
Sure.
That's right. Enhanced. How much enhanced techniques do we use? And this, like I'm saying, I do not think these are easy decisions to make, and I don't know that any one thing can answer the question on the spot for you. Well, let me go to the handbook and see and do the calculus. I don't think that's doable that way. I wish it were. But this is why, you know, I think this present witch hunt that's going on is ill-conceived. The circumstances were very extreme 10 years ago, not that we are not justified in making moral critiques, but we have to make sure those moral critiques are sound and they're not just improperly idealistic. We live in a fallen world, and presidents have responsibilities to protect their people first. That's why they're elected, to run and guard and protect the people and our way of life, a constitutional way of life. So the person who's down in the dark room having to do what he has to do is, you know, that's the hard place to be. But that doesn't mean the decisions that are hard, that are necessary in a fallen world, aren't the right decisions in a fallen world. And I don't know of any book I can give you on this one.
No, that's fine. I mean, you've like I said, you've helped tremendously, and I'll just, you know, keep thinking about it.
Yeah. I wish I could think of something. I just can't. It's a combination of training that I've had that's all coming together here. The person who's helped me a lot on some of these things is Dennis Prager.
I listen to him plenty. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if he's taught me on this one or we just both agree and he's more articulate about expressing it, but I think he's a Jewish thinker that doesn't share my particular religious convictions, but when it comes to these kinds of things, I think he's exceptionally clear-headed, and he is. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that. Okay.
Yeah. No. Thank you so much, Greg.
All right, Nick. All the best to you, and happy Christmas. Okay.
Yep. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Bye bye now. All right. Let's take a break. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. I attended a gay Christian conference that intends to reform the church to make it affirm practicing homosexuals. Find out about my experience in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every week, 3 hours of Clear Thinking Christianity. The live show is 4 to 7 on Tuesday nights, Los Angeles time, and that's the time to call in. I understand we have a new feature now on our app. That is, if you go to our STR app, which you get for free, either an Android version or for iPhone, when you go to the radio section or page, you can actually call in during the show, which I think is fabulous, which it might be how some of the callers on board here have contacted me. So that's great. But STR app, we actually have two of those apps. We have the standard STR app. Now we have a quick reference app. And if you're interested in a number of topics, including the tactics material or being an ambassador, the issue of abortion or same-sex marriage or whatever, these are different chapters in the quick reference app where you can get quick information regarding challenges in each of those areas. And I think those have videos. They have video with them, right, and text. So it's a combination. I'm talking with Brooke here, who's my board op and also in charge of that area at Stand to Reason. And so really helpful to you. I'm glad that we're able to put things like that out, and we'll be doing more of that as time goes on, all to help you be more effective in making a difference for the cause of Christ through your life. Let's go to Maui. This is Jason. Hello, Jason.
Oh, hey, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, it's interesting talking with Jason from Maui. My discipler is the pastor. My first discipler, Craig Engler, is the pastor of Hope Chapel Kihei, and one of his first pastors was Jason, a guy that I grew up with in the Lord, you know, in our early years. Now he's no longer with us; he's with the Lord. But to see Jason from Maui makes me think of J-Boy. So,
yeah, you know, that's Jason Spence. He was definitely a discipler of mine as well. And by God's grace, I'm actually teaching some of the courses that he taught there at the church, the School of the Bible. So,
well, we started so, the Lord in the Lord together. We started. I met Jason, I think, in the summer of 1974 in Honolulu doing a summer outreach project there, and then he came to the mainland, and we went to school together at this place I'd referred to earlier in the show, the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse. So I had, you know, he was a dear friend, and I know a faithful servant of the Lord there in Maui, and I'm glad that he had an impact in your life too, Jason.
Oh, such an impact, mm-hmm. such a huge impact, mm-hmm. and love him and miss him, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking my call, Greg, and
sure.
Definitely, as always, I'm so blessed personally by just your wisdom and how the Lord's used you and everybody at STR. Just mm-hmm. your ministry has blessed my life so much.
Good.
And
thank you.
Yeah, my question today, I guess, I had a few, but I guess we can start with the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a real practical one. I've talked to you before about my brother-in-law,
mm-hmm.
and that he's with his partner, and in the state where they live, they are, you know, considered married.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if I'm asked by my peers or coworkers or even extended family, some that don't really know, don't keep in touch with him all that much, you know, if how to answer a real kind of practical question, if they were to ask me, so is your brother married? You know, I just don't know if I'd want to say, well, yes, outright that he's married, because I don't view that as a marriage,
uh-huh.
you know?
Right.
But I don't want to be overly critical, and mm-hmm. the way these questions come up, you know, it's usually in real casual conversation. So
mm-hmm. sure.
I guess that's what I'm looking for is a tactical way that's friendly, but at the same time not compromising.
Yeah, you know, once I realized what you're going to ask, my mind has been turning this issue over the last 60 seconds or something here, and so I'm wondering. I don't know that you can. If you the easiest way is to say, yes, they're married. But then I understand your concern, because now you're kind of playing along with the trend and giving in for the whole thing. And then you wonder, maybe I should keep standing my ground in some sense. But if you try to stand your ground in any way, then I think it's going to draw attention to it. So I don't know if there is any way to answer the spirit of the question without affirming the marriage notion that won't draw attention to your answer, all right?
Right.
That is, you don't want to say yes, and I'm with you there. But if you said, well, after a fashion, then they're going to say, what do you mean after a fashion?
Even the Columbo questions may come off disrespectful. Well, what do you mean by that?
Yes, of course. Here's the phrase or the response that came to mind, again, with the qualification that this isn't going to let you off the hook. You're probably going to get a question about it. But you, if they say, are they married? And you might say, well, in the sense that I think you mean the term, yes.
In the sense
that I think you mean the term, that's my hidden emphasis, but in the sense that you mean the term, yes.
Is that, you know, again, I'm not looking to make things more difficult than
I need to.
And I don't want to pick a fight or anything like that.
Right, I understand.
But do you think under those circumstances, maybe that's the easiest one, and
it's
then
the
just break for
one.
Whatever comes next?
Yes, of course. And they might ask for clarification. What do you mean? Well, most people, I should say, I'm role-playing it now. Maybe I would say in response, I'd say, well, many people think that the term marriage between two same-sex people makes sense. I don't, but I understand that's a standard way the phrase is being used. So in the sense that I think you're using it, yes, I could answer yes to that. Now you're showing your hand a little bit more, but that doesn't sound acrimonious to me, but you know how it goes sometimes in these things, that there's nothing you could say that if it even suggests something out of order, then you're going to get pushback on it. So, but that's all that comes to mind at this point. Yes, in the sense that you probably mean it, they are married. I'm thinking right now, and I don't know any other way to approach that or to get out of that. And look at this. This issue, blast it. You know, we cannot get away. There is, the culture is set up in a way now. And as I stand back from things, I think this is spiritual warfare maneuvering. This is heavy, large spiritual warfare strategy. What I mean is the spiritual forces in heavenly places are working this out magnificently for them. They are putting us in a very awkward position. We are not going to be able to bow out of this situation. All we can do, we can either give full-fledged support and encouragement and endorsement, or we can get beaten up. That's all. That's the only two options that are left to us, I think, in 98% of the circumstances. Most people on the other side are not going to be generous and charitable. You know, so and what that means is it makes us feel awkward. And so a lot of Christians are thinking, oh, man, I don't want to create a fuss. Oh, yeah, they're married. OK. And so then we go along with it. And then the other side gets a rhetorical victory, it seems. And I do think that there's some point in which we realize that the times have changed, and there's a certain kind of, now I got to be careful how I say this. There's a certain kind of acceptance of the circumstances that I think is appropriate. That is not the same thing as kind of going along and accepting the party line.
Sure, I understand the distinction, yeah.
And I'm not always sure what that looks like. I know that a number of years ago when there was an opportunity for a same-sex couple to come visit our home, there was a clarification being made that we did not want that same-sex couple to come to our home the way they wanted to come to our home, because it would look like it was normal and a good thing. The one individual who was related to the family is welcome to come, but not with that person's paramour, you know?
Yes.
Now I think I might maybe have a little different perspective on that. I might be a little bit more relaxed on that circumstance. I'm not sure. I still am really strong on the wedding question. You go to a wedding to celebrate. If you can't celebrate, you shouldn't go. And I think,
I'm there with you.
Right. But then, okay, now let's just say 10 years from now, maybe 2 years from now, when the culture has completely gone over, do we still keep trying to fight a losing battle, that is, the battle to change the culture? Or do we accept the new set of circumstances and think how we can maneuver most godly in the midst of the new circumstances, the new normal? And,
right.
Does that look different? And I think it does. I think when we're if you pardon the phrase, fighting the culture war, and I think there is such a thing, when we're fighting for the culture to look a certain way because it's good for the culture, it's good for people, we are fighting for appropriate civic morality. That's why we have laws against things that are harmful to people, because we're fighting for an appropriate civic morality, though we understand that civic morality doesn't save anybody, but it keeps us from harming ourselves to a great degree, right?
Right.
So when with regards to a particular issue, we've lost the battle. Okay, then maybe we need to regroup, accept the loss, and then figure out now how do we maneuver most effectively for the kingdom purposes in this new circumstance. And that means then maybe same-sex couples are welcome in our home, you know, and participate with us in certain things just like any other couple would. For example, maybe a heterosexual couple that's living together and is not married.
Right. And you would hope to apply, you know, consistent standards because of that. But I certainly understand where you're coming from. And yeah, it's interesting because that's kind of the last time we spoke had to do with that pretty much that issue, is just that parsing out the differences. You know, my wife and I have been invited to spend Christmas with my brother-in-law and his partner in the mainland.
By the way, I think that's a fair way of putting it, with his partner. I think that's nuanced and fair, and it's neutral, so good for you.
Right. And it's also something, to your point earlier, it's something that I would apply to a heterosexual couple that was maybe living together for many years.
Uh-huh.
You know, it'd be their partner.
By the way,
so I'm not making. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Good. And do you have children?
No.
Okay. Because to me, children in the mix, I've got a 9 and a 2, soon to be 10 and 7. And maybe I should start saying that because they're just a few days away in one case. So say I got a 10 and a 7. I am very concerned about how they. Let me back up. I'm very concerned about how they view these things, for one. But I'm also very concerned about their innocence. Wait a minute. That's a same-sex couple married. That means what is up with that? And I don't want them to be introduced to things related to human sexuality before it's appropriate for them.
I agree. That changes the equation, and it sets in front of me, at least, implications in the future for, mm-hmm. for my children one day, mm-hmm. About their, in this case, uncle.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
How much involvement, what kind, so I agree. That I may call you at that time too, Greg.
Yeah, well, I was raised, there was a lesbian woman who was a cousin of my mom, and she was masculine. I remember this growing up. I never knew, probably until I was in high school, I didn't kind of connect the dots, but no one ever said anything about it. She was just a member of the family, and so she was at events and stuff like that, and occasionally she might have had another woman friend with her.
Right.
And so Well, nobody was, kids were none the wiser regarding that, and there was no need for us to know. So having family members around that are like that, especially with children, if these topics are not discussed, great. And if the same-sex couple is careful about their behavior, and 50 years ago they were. They were the ones on the outside of culture, as it were, the outside of the mainstream, and they tended to be more careful about how they behaved in public. This is not the case anymore, so you can't always count on that. But when you have family members like brothers and partners like that, it may be the case with them that they are willing to be more careful about the behavior out of respect for you and your children. But again, you cannot count on that anymore.
Right.
And so that to me would be a factor. If
I agree.
So that's all part of the negotiation with these things, with family members. So it sounds to me your attitude is a good one. It's charitable towards your brother and the circumstances. And I think most Christians have a live and let live attitude about these things, all things being equal. You know, that is not true from the other side.
Yeah, I see that, you know, again, as we kind of talked about the last time, that, you know, I'm extending fellowship mm-hmm. to him, and that's what I'm participating in,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily affirming or celebrating their union mm-hmm. like I would be, clearly, at a ceremony, at a wedding.
Right.
So I do see that difference there. And I want to be, you know, I hope that there are opportunities to have, you know, good conversations and love on them, you
uh-huh.
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm sure you will. And as you pray to that end, I think God will provide those. But these kinds of conversations, the one that we're having here, Jason, more of this is coming. There's more complication coming. And I'm glad that, you know, we're talking a little bit. So between us, we can kind of hammer out our behavior here, because we want to be good ambassadors. We want to be faithful to the truth, but we also don't want to force, we don't want to expect non-Christians to live like Christians, do we?
Right. They're going to fulfill their job description.
Yeah.
So,
that's right.
That's not a problem. it kind of reminded me that, you know, the last time we spoke, you asked me a question that we weren't able to get to.
Hey, Jason, listen, the music is up. That means we're out of time. So why don't you save this part of the conversation to our next conversation, all right?
Next time, Greg.
Okay, sounds good. Jason, say hi to the crowd over there at Hope Chapel Kihei and tell them I love them, all right? It's a good call. And time's up for this hour. We've got another hour ahead of us. Please stay with us here on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me. Greg Kokel here. A little more than 2 weeks before Christmas. That's a scary thought for me since I haven't hardly started anything. My wife has got all the Christmas goodies out. I haven't done the outside decorations yet, but she's done the inside stuff and still working on it and always does a fabulous job. And so I'm starting to get a little bit into it. Probably in a few days we'll have a tree. I have a book here that I have read portions of that I love as a great book to understand the traditions of Christmas, and it's called The Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas by Ace Collins. We are actually sending this out this month to those of you who give us a gift towards our end-of-year program in December, and I very rarely mention money, but I don't mind doing so when I do, because unless we have your help, we can't continue. It's just that simple. We do sell some product, and the product pays for product pretty much. Cost of goods and overhead, and we're done. We're not making a lot of money on that. We don't intend to. We want to put things in your hands at a fair price that will help you. But it isn't what makes the engine go here. It is your saying thanks to us for the work we've done in your life by sending gifts month to month. And many of you are our strategic partners. That means you have a monthly commitment of a certain amount, and we can count on you. And this is what allows us to be able to stay in business month to month, too. But we usually will offer some kind of gift or way of saying thank you. And this month, we have the Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas. Just wanted to mention to you because it's a great little handy book that you can use with your kids and family and understand the background information to things from carols and caroling to Handel and holly and lights and mistletoe and candy canes and Christmas seals and Christmas movies and poinsettias. I mean, I'm just looking down 12 days of Christmas, Yule logs, everything. It's a lot of fun. But the most important thing is not the book. The most important thing is our relationship, stand to reason. So if you have not given this year, we have a big nut to crack in December, just like we do every year. I'm just letting you know. You may want to participate. Before I get to the calls, I read a letter in our local paper. Actually, what I was doing was lighting a fire. And I pulled the paper out of the paper stack. And you know how it is when you go to paper up for the fire and something catches your eyes. This was letters to the editor section of our local community paper. And the title of it was Dislike is Not Intolerance. I thought, that looks like my kind of letter. And I read it, and I liked it. So I thought I'd just read it to you quickly because this is the kind of point that needs to be made more often. Now, it ends a tad aggressive, so I'm just warning you in advance, at least for my tastes. But I like the point. The writer says, I'm responding to, I'm just using first name here, Susan's letter in which she attacked writer Tina for expressing an opinion. Susan accused Tina of intolerance. Susan stated that Tina was not, quote, endearing herself to others, close quote. And then the writer says, be careful whom you accuse, Susan. I've heard you scream intolerance before. It's not exactly endearing to insult and ridicule other people's opinions. Now, this is a little bit of the suicide tactic in play. You might recognize, now I don't know if this writer, Robin, has any familiarity with Stand to Reason, but the move here is classic. Robin continues to write, check your dictionary, intolerance doesn't mean dislike. Anyone is free to dislike an idea and ought not be accused of intolerance for it. Reread the First Amendment that you grandiloquently quote. Nowhere does that brilliant statement forbid us from disliking another person's speech. In the United States, we allow other people to speak freely. It's a concept we common folk refer to as free speech. Many have struggled to defend that concept throughout our nation's history. This editorial page is part of that idea. Your derisive attack on someone who simply expressed an opinion was boorish, but yes, you are perfectly free to say whatever you choose to say. It's your privilege to overstep the boundaries of common civility as long as you do not break the law. I dislike your opinions, but I respect your right to have them. Lecture me, call me intolerant, if that gives your ego a boost. That was a little bit of a cheap shot there, but you have no monopoly on virtue, patriotism, freedom, and love of nation and the Constitution. It's irrelevant, and this I think more to the point, it's irrelevant to the discussion if you're Jewish, Zoroastrian, Hindu, or no preference. I do not want my freedoms in your hands. I would then have to seek redress of a grievance from that. Impress your cronies with your bombastic interpretation of the Constitution. Speak freely. Do not, however, expect others to remain silent when you insult them. They might insult you back. It's a free country, even for a smug, self-righteous, sanctimonious person like you. Not to worry, the First Amendment has your back. Now, like I said, I think it the quality of this letter degraded a little bit there towards the end, because there's no need to snipe at other people that you disagree with when you have a good, solid point, which this writer did in the beginning. And that's where I think that we ought to stay when we're making our points. So probably the last third could have been omitted. But anyway, I like it when this point is made publicly, dislike or judgment that something's wrong or immoral is not itself intolerance. There ought to be a place for public discourse on contentious moral issues. Name-calling, that is, faulting someone's character for their point of view by calling them intolerant, is not a productive way to go. All right, let's go to another Frank in Barstow. Today's the day for Franks, Frank. Welcome to the show.
I guess so.
So what do we got today?
Well, this is a... I waited for so long to call in, and I don't know what to say now.
You want me to tell you what your topic is? I got it written here in front of me.
Oh, no, I remember that. I had all these thoughts about how I would introduce myself to you running through my head.
Let me give you a little clue. When I have to make phone calls like that where I want to get in smoothly, I always write it down and read it, even though I can read it, but people can't tell I'm reading it.
I actually did that for a different question that I have decided not to call about because I already figured out the answer.
Oh, okay.
I'll just say this up front. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a little starstruck, I guess. I've been listening to you for a little while now on the podcast, on the app, and I started from the earliest podcast that the app had on it and worked my way up to the present.
Wow.
So
you're dedicated.
It's been well, you have a lot of good stuff to say, and it's something that's been a habit of mine to listen to apologetics podcasts like this one when I'm doing other tasks where I don't need to be fully engaged with my mind, and I can do something while I'm listening to you in the background
that's
and then
great.
Hear it. Anyway, so doing it that way, you hear a lot of things, and you start to pick up trends.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this idea that I would tell you that I'm not from Lansing, Michigan. I'm not a fisherman,
okay,
but I am a woodworker, so I think we might have that in common.
Sure, of course.
I love Keith Green, although I'm not old enough to really remember him as a, from going to concerts, but I love his music and what he did when he was around. So, anyway.
Well, good.
So here's my question. I'll give you a little bit of context, and I'll try to just get right to it.
Okay.
I work in Barstow, and I have two or three Christians that I work with, and we have been gathering together every week just to have some Bible study, prayer time, more of a Christian support group in a sense. We really just want to gather together, and we want to pray for each other, hear what's going on, and offer each other encouragement. But every once in a while, it turns into a little bit of a minor Bible study. So one of my friends that I do that with, last time we got together, kind of at the end, he threw something out there about Christmas and how he doesn't think that we should celebrate Christmas, and I wasn't too keen on getting into it with him, but I did ask him a couple of questions about how he came to that conclusion and, you know, why did he think that and things like that. And he is a very knowledgeable person about the Bible, as in memorization. I think he comes to some wrong conclusions. But essentially, he he has two problems with Christmas and Easter. He ties them in together, and it's because he can't find anything in the Bible that tells us to celebrate the birth of Christ or the resurrection of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the coin, he doesn't like some of the traditions that have come up around Christmas and Easter that, you know, you may be able to tie to pagan practices from the Druids or the, you know, of that nature. So I understand his point of view. I don't really want to get into that. But the thing that really caught my attention was when he said the only things we should be celebrating are the feasts and the festivals that God directed the Israelites to celebrate in the Old Testament. And he said, I was really shocked to hear that because I've never heard anyone ever proclaim that before who's a, say, a New Testament Christian. He's not a Jew, or he's not a he's not a Jew. He doesn't have any of that heritage in him. Although he does tend to, he told me this, he views things from a Hebrew perspective. I'm not exactly sure what that means. We don't, I don't know him well enough to get into all the, have figured all this out yet. So there's still a lot for me to learn about this guy.
Sure.
But I'm curious to hear what your opinion is on whether or not you think a case could be made for his claim that we should observe the Old Testament feasts.
Well, it's
not in a salvation way, not that it's going to get us saved, but that as Christians we should celebrate it, such as the way we're directed to celebrate the communion or to observe communion. So that's the question.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that he does not want to celebrate Easter or Christmas because nowhere in the Bible does it tell us to celebrate that, yet nowhere in the Bible does God direct Gentiles to practice Hebrew or celebrate Hebrew celebrations or feasts either. These are given to Jews to celebrate. So wouldn't the same objection apply to a Gentile celebrating Jewish feasts, the one that he raised against the resurrection and Christmas?
That is, I didn't put it exactly that way, but that's kind of the first thing I thought of when he brought this up.
Yeah.
I don't know if I did a very good job of making that point.
Well, that's okay. I just bring that up. It strikes me as a kind of contradiction there in his approach. Yes, God told someone to do the feast, but he didn't tell Gentiles to do that. And if his thinking is it's wrong to participate in a celebration that is religious that God does not ordain, then he should not be participating in the Feast of Booths because God did not ordain that for Gentiles. He should not participate in Passover since God did not ordain that for Gentiles. He should not participate in Hanukkah because God did not ordain that for anybody. That is a choice that the Jews made, this Feast of Lights or Celebration of Lights, however they characterize it, that has to do with a supernatural event, apparently, that happened in the intertestamental period, but it was not a feast ordained by God. Now, I don't fault it for that reason, but he ought to. So just based on consistency of thinking, he should stay away from all of the festivals because there are no festivals or feasts ordained for Gentiles. The only thing that is directed is, as you pointed out, the Lord's Supper, and that is to proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. So there's a memorial of a sorts there. But so I think that there's an inconsistency right off the bat with his approach. But there's also a problem. There's an assumption that he's making regarding Easter and and Christmas, and the assumption is that we should not celebrate something religious unless God tells us to. So where does he get the idea that it's inappropriate to celebrate something unless God spiritual unless God tells you to celebrate it? I don't know why he assumes that.
I want to give him, you know, I want to be charitable to his point of view.
Okay.
So I don't want to say what I think he might think until I hear him, you know, articulate it. But I think with those two specific things, he also made the point that only, you know, we talk about the, I heard you made this point before about redeeming something, you know, for its proper use, such yeah. as, say, you know, Christmas or the day of winter equinox, Christmas
yeah,
day
or something
being
like
December
that.
25th.
Right. That speaks to the second element, though, not to the first, and we can get that to in just a moment. But can we stick
yeah.
with the first challenge first? I mean, the first
okay.
thing that you brought up, just for a few minutes. This is I just think this is a huge mistake for him to presume that if the scripture does not, in a sense, command or endorse a celebration about a certain thing, then we should not be celebrating. Look, I just earlier I talked about Advent and this verse that my family went over yesterday. We opened up with the John chapter 1 through 14, and verse 14 mm-hmm. talks about the Word becoming flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, here's my question. Is that a glorious thing, the incarnation? Obviously it is. Is it a wonderful
yes.
thing? Right. Should we rejoice in that? Yes.
I would say absolutely.
Should we celebrate that?
Sure.
Of course. So then if there is a truth that is wonderful that we should rejoice at and celebrate in, then having a celebration to celebrate the thing and rejoice in the thing, how is that bad? I mean, the incarnation is the most magnificent thing in the history of the world. God coming to this earth. Oh, look at even that first Christmas there, the whole heavenly host. In the birth narratives we read is celebrating. Why shouldn't we celebrate when the whole heavenly host is celebrating? Why shouldn't we celebrate? This to me is I don't get it. I see no reason not to. And to presume that we shouldn't when there's no reason not to, I think is a false presumption. It's silly,
okay.
I think, to say. And the same thing with the resurrection. The incarnation and the resurrection are extolled all through the New Testament. If they're extolled by the writers, why can't we extol them as a group, as a church, as a family? What's wrong with that? Why do we need permission to rejoice as a group? Okay. So mm-hmm. so that's the response to the first objection. The second objection is one that I have covered before, and it's the one you just mentioned a few moments ago. You're going back to the trappings
yes.
of the season seem to have occultic or pagan origins. Okay, so did you want me to speak to that, or did you want to say something about it?
Well, I'll say what he specifically told me about those, and I think I would hold to your view, but anyway, I'll let you say that. So he was talking about things like the day, or some of the association, some of the, like you said, the trappings, say a Yule log or a Christmas tree, or mm-hmm. any number of things. Even the name Easter, I guess, and I didn't know this, but I guess it comes from a Roman deity or something, Astraeus, something of that nature.
Uh-huh.
And he thinks his specific words were, we should never associate Christ with any of those things. He doesn't like even using the word Christmas because in his mind, you know, that is associating Christ with something that is evil, not of God. I guess I can understand his desire to not associate Christ with things that are evil, but I would take the view that, well, I had a really good argument for that. Maybe I'll tell you that after you say your piece. I kind of figured out talking with my wife about, you know, redeeming things. But he did say, you know, we can't redeem something. Only Christ can. Only Christ is the redeemer. And that, for him, that was kind of the end of it. So.
Well, look it. When I take a pawn ticket in to the pawn shop and I give them the ticket, I am redeeming my item with a payment of a price. I get the item back when I put down the money. That's called redeeming. We get coupons in the mail, and the coupons have a redemptive value or whatever. Just because you're using the same word, redeem, that is used to describe what Jesus did for us, doesn't mean that we're using it in the same way. Oh, wait, I'm not going to redeem that coupon. Nope, Jesus is the redeemer. I can't redeem anything. That's silly. That's just flat out
okay.
silly, okay? And so when you use the phrase, we are redeeming this, taking a cultural thing that is either benign or maybe even evil, and we are changing the meaning and we are redeeming it for something good, we are not talking about anything akin to Jesus' redemption. We are just talking about taking something that has a secular use and giving it a different value in our usage. That's all. That is such a silly way of arguing. It shows me that a person isn't even understanding the way you're using your words. All right? But I also think this other line of argument is also silly. And please, I don't mean to be condescending regarding this person, but when somebody says somebody else used a tree to worship false gods, therefore, when you have a tree in your house, you are worshiping a false god. There is nothing inherent about a tree and false gods. Paul himself said that an idol, even an idol, a pagan idol that itself is used, the very idol that is used for worshiping false gods, is nothing. It is nothing. Isaiah said regarding those who make idols, he says, they have eyes they cannot see, they have ears they cannot hear, they have mouths that they cannot speak, and those who make them are like them. Notice how the thing that is being used in this idolatrous practice, though the practice itself is bad, the thing is nothing. The thing is completely dismissed. So that's the thing used for these practices itself. The tree in my house isn't the thing somebody else. I didn't take my tree from a pagan temple, and now I'm using it in my house. I've just got a tree that was just cut down. How can somebody say that I'm doing something pagan when I do that? It's so unsound, the thinking. It just strikes me as so obvious that there's nothing wrong. So maybe this eternal was December 4th. What am I going to do on that day? Can I not do anything religious on the Saturnal, whatever that day that was, you know, that they worshipped false gods or something? Well, anything that I do is going to be something done on that day. Am I then associating my God with that false practice? Of course not. I'm not. Somebody might have carved a pumpkin to scare away a demon. I'm carving a pumpkin to put a candle in it to look nice on my doorstep during All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day. You know, I'm not doing the same thing they're doing. It's just as simple as that. There is nothing inherently pagan about a tree. For me to enjoy a tree or enjoy a plant for that, or a bouquet of flowers. How is a bouquet of flowers any different? I lived in Thailand for 7 months, And in Thailand, and you can also see this in Thai restaurants, if you look high and in the corners, you could see a little house with a little dish, maybe food or liquid, and that's for the spirit of that property. And they have these things all over. They put food out, these little houses. They look like birdhouses. If you don't know what's going on when you go to Bangkok, you'll see these birdhouses. What's up with the birdhouses? Well, does that mean that if I have a birdhouse in my yard, that I'm somehow inviting spirits because there's another structure that looks like it that people use for a spiritual purpose? No. Doesn't mean that. What does he feel about a creche? Oh, he didn't like anything associated with Christmas, so they might object to that too. I don't know. It's like I'm trying to come up with counterexamples to show how silly this is. And I know that people hold these things with strong convictions. And if he really, honestly, genuinely believes that he is participating in paganism, if he even names the name of Christ associated with Christmas, he can't even say the word Christmas. Well, then he shouldn't do it. He shouldn't violate his own conscience. But I think his conscience is deeply misinformed in this. So, it doesn't strike me that he's going to listen to you. To the contrary. It's like straining at a gnat, you know.
I hadn't thought of applying that particular phrase, but...
Well, Jesus said straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. I don't know if he's swallowing a camel here, but he is straining at a gnat. He's straining at something totally inconsequential.
I agree. And you know, just so I clear my conscience a little bit, you know, I didn't call you up so that I could, you know, secretly behind his back sort of you know, malign his character or anything.
No,
but,
his character is not in question here, for me. His judgment is, but not his character.
Okay.
He seems like he is a character a little bit, but but
not character. He's a wonderful brother and Lord. I love him to death. You know, just in this particular thing, it kind of surprised me. So,
what about burying the dead? You know, before Christianity, Jews buried the dead, right? And then Jesus was buried after the fashion of the Jews. Jesus was embalmed, actually, had 100 pounds of spices on his body, and he's wrapped according to the tradition of the Jews. And Egyptians were embalmed. So there, you've got Egyptians embalmed because they believe that in the afterlife, but their view of the afterlife was completely different than our view. But does embalming a person or wrapping them up and burying them in a coffin somehow mean that we're participating in the religious beliefs that Egyptians had just because we're largely doing the same thing with the dead body? Maybe there's an example you can give to him. I don't know. We got to run. We got some more callers on board. I got to go to break and finish the show here. Frank, maybe that'll give you something to chew on and maybe your friend to think about. All right?
Yes, thank you very much, Greg.
All right, Frank, appreciate the call and happy Christmas to you. Go to break right now and back after this.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Back at you here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind as I do every Tuesday night from 4 until 7. That's the live show here in Los Angeles, West Coast time. The number 855-243-9975 if you don't have it. Best way to get in touch with me. We got callers on, so let's go back to them. In Long Beach, right here. Aaron, hey, welcome. You're right around the corner.
Yeah, hey, Greg, are you guys in Signal Hill?
We're in Signal Hill, just between Orange and Cherry, just north of the 405.
Gotcha. Yeah, my wife and I, we just moved to the area, and I said, I think Greg's like right there, somewhere
right.
Signal Hill.
Yeah, if you listen out the window, you might hear my voice.
I know, right? Well, hey, I just want to say thanks for taking my call, and I want to say a thank you to all the folks at STR that make everything possible.
Well, you're welcome. From all of them, you're welcome. We enjoy serving you and the rest of those who are benefiting from what we do. We really do.
Yeah, every time I get, you know, just some downtime, I have a couple different apps, and I'll go through, see, okay, did they update the blog, and I'll read, you know, Amy's post or Melinda's,
Right.
Really like in to read those guys.
Yeah, Amy's in the other room right now listening to the show, and she's this is so she can kind of keep up with the details to make her post tomorrow and respond to people. She's got some insight I'll offer a little bit later having to do with Old Testament feasts. I know because I've got another caller coming up on that issue. But, it's a great team, and I'm glad to work side by side with them.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Okay, a little bit of background on my question. I was speaking to a New Ager, and we were discussing contentment, and she was trying to relate to me, you know, in my Christian perspective. So I've noticed that, is it that I'll ask them questions, and they go, well, you know, let's start with what you believe, and they try and adapt to your perspective. So that was fine, but however, what ended up coming out of the conversation was the question of, well, if there's this belief and there's some scriptures you can use to back it up, if God meets all of our needs, then why should we ask God for anything? So the specific example is, you know, I want a new car, you know, or I want this iPad for Christmas. I mean, that's kind of one end of the spectrum, but it can bridge all the way over to, you know, I want my grandmother to not have cancer, come back to her body. So it's kind of those things.
Sure, I'm not quite sure I understand. I thought I understood it at first, the nature of this objection from your New Age friend, but now I'm not quite sure I understand why. That God may have promised to meet all our needs, and we have precious and magnificent promises, for example, regarding lots of different things. In fact, I think that's in 1 Peter, and I was just scanning to see if I could find it. But or maybe it's in 2 Peter, I don't know. But okay, but now I'm not sure. It sounds like just because God would provide all of our needs doesn't mean that there aren't some things that we can ask for. Whether my grandma dies of cancer or not is not my need, but it's her need.
I see. So okay, that makes sense, the distinction there.
It says here in 2 Peter chapter 1, grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Notice, by the way, this is the precious promises passage, and that's why I've gone to it. But I just want you to notice, Paul is saying, grace and peace be multiplied to you. That's a prayer. He's praying that grace and peace be multiplied. And how is it multiplied? In the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord, seeing that his divine power, God's Jesus' divine power, has granted to us everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of him who called us by his own glory for by these he has granted to us his precious and magnificent promises, so that by them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that's in the world by lust. So there's your pericope, your paragraph, basically. And then there's more that follows. But what's interesting is, it seems to me that what Peter is declaring is that there's certain things that are made available to you, and that he has made promises. But the benefit of these promises are received or experienced in virtue of a true knowledge that we have about God. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Now, I don't think that means just knowing facts. I think that means being in intimate relationship with God, that his divine power has granted us everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of him who called us. So, there is a promise, and there's a thing made available, but there is also a part that we play in the participation of the reception and the experience of those things. This is where it becomes a little bit hard to describe, but it isn't like, okay, God has given us everything, so what's to ask for? Well, he's made everything available that we need, but there's a getting of that and a participating in the getting of that through asking and trusting and praying and whatever. There's a dynamic thing going on. I have everything my daughters need to live adequately, right? But that doesn't mean that there is no interaction between us. No, Papa, I'm hungry. Will you get, you know...
Yeah,
I sometimes fault my daughter, my youngest, because she just announces her need. So she doesn't ask politely for help or for. She has said, "I'm thirsty." You know, we're at the dinner table. I'm thirsty. Honey, how about if you say, Mommy, can I please have some milk? Okay, Mommy, can I please have some milk? I want more food. You know, well, wait a minute. But there is a sense, when I think about this, I know we're guiding her, but in the same sense, there is a legitimacy. I'm dad. She expresses her need. I'm the right one, or mom is the right one. Parents are the right ones to fulfill those needs. And by the same token, we express our need to the Father. Now, the resources are there to fulfill the need. The promise is there that God will respond, but it's initiated through the interactive relation, knowledge of Him, the intimacy there, and the true knowledge that He is capable. So I think this is all bound together. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It's I'm just trying to think how I want to phrase the question. I mean, what she kept coming back to is, I reiterated her question. I said, it seems to you that if we were really in touch and we really believed that God, you know, provided all of our needs for us to be happy, you know, you don't need a large amount of material blessings to be happy. Mm-hmm. You already have that. You have the ability to be assertive and proactive and, you know, plus you're born in America, sort of thing. So you have all those things. So wouldn't the appropriate response be just merely talking to God or praising Him or giving thanksgiving, not necessarily, God, I want this, I want this.
But is that what she said to you or what you're saying back to her?
I was reiterating
her view, and what did she say?
And she said, yeah, that's it.
None of those things that you described are things that are really essential. Being in America, being, you know, having certain material possessions are—I don't know that they're the kind of thing that God is concerned about. So concerned about providing for us the iPad or whatever. I know we pray for these things, but I think when you look at the prayers of those in the New Testament, they are much more concerned about God's ultimate purposes than they are concerned about their own, you know, health, wealth, and prosperity. In fact, my pastor was going through Philippians, make that Ephesians chapter 6, spiritual armor, last weekend. And what's interesting at the bottom of all of this, Paul's in prison when he's writing this, and he says, pray on my behalf. He's an ambassador in chains. Pray on my behalf, what, that I'd be released from prison? No, he didn't ask for that. He said that I can speak as I ought to speak. With boldness, you know. So there, he's concerned with God's ultimate purposes, not for satisfying his own immediate needs. So I don't understand this as something like a substantive objection to Christianity, or at least to your take of Christianity. You know, I guess I'm not entirely sure about what she thinks the problem is here.
I grew up in a fairly ritualistic Christian upbringing, and ritualistic almost in the terms of legalistic, how it can be that way, where every single night we always sat down and we said, you know, my dad would ask for various things, you know, happiness, contentment, you know, and thank you for the food and everything.
You mean and it was, as a prayer for the family there? Is that what you mean? That was a standard grace before meals?
Okay. And so the model that I was brought up thinking prayer was is you ask God for things, kind of the first thing you ask for, and then you thank Him for things. And it in trying to reevaluate, you know, okay, what does the Bible say, what works for me? Like, I'm pretty content. Like, I don't really, you know, there's nothing I'm longing for other than to be, you know, a better person. You know, I mean, that's all I could really
ask for.
I understand that there's a, I totally get the daughter parent role and how that's just kind of a natural happening. And it kind of, it changed when I learned that prayer means, you know, talking to God, not necessarily asking Him for things. Because when you say, God, we pray that you would do this. God, we pray that this would happen.
Yeah, a big part of prayer is communion with God. It's being together with God. But when you think about the Lord's Prayer, which is the disciples' prayer, There's prayer of praise there. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. There's an appeal for thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So there's God's purposes there. And then there's some requests for personal things. Give us this day our daily bread. Deliver us from the evil one. Forgive us as we forgive others. So there's a whole mixture of things, and which I think are true of genuine communion with God. There are a lot, certainly. Asking for things is a part. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God, Philippians 4. So that's part of it. But you're also touching on something that I think is richer and deeper than that, and that is a communing, practicing the presence of God. My soul waits in silence for God only, Psalmist said in Psalm 62. For him is from him is my salvation. He is my rock. And salvation, my refuge. So there are times when that's it. We're just before the Lord, communing and trusting in the midst of a hardship and difficult and heartache. So there's a whole range of things that are part of prayer and not just the asking for stuff. Though asking for stuff is still an important part. And of course, when I say stuff, I don't mean just inconsequential stuff. When you're asking for God to heal relationships or heal bodies of people who are dying, Or give wisdom. That's stuff, but it's not material stuff. It's good stuff. It's stuff we need.
Yeah.
Anybody who lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. You know, so there's a whole range of stuff that are appropriate to ask of that are profound.
And
weighty.
I mean, I relate to her asking this, and at the same time with, you know, we covered, you know, asking for external material things, but for the good things, you know, like I may pray for a family's marriage to get better and pray and pray and pray and pray and pray and ask and every day and do it ritualistically, hoping that it would get fixed. And if it doesn't get fixed, it seems like the typical Christian answer is, well, you know, that's God's sovereignty, whether he chose to fix it or not. And I'm more like, well, I'd rather not. I don't want to waste my time. I know that doesn't sound very good, and it's kind of missing the point. Is that you're trying to commune with God, not necessarily get from A to B. Like, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I do think that part of it is getting from A to B, and the reason I say that is because I can actually see examples of that in the text, prayers that are prayed. And some of them have to do with, I pray that the eyes of your heart may be opened, okay, so that you may know the length and breadth and the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, you know, things like that. So there are things that are kind of deeply and profoundly spiritual that are prayed for, but then there are also very precise, there are other kinds of things. You have not. Because you ask not.
Yes, and that kind of goes against everything that I said before.
Yeah.
If God's given you everything, then, you know, and then it's like, well, you don't have everything because you didn't ask.
Yeah, right. Here's a Colossians chapter 1, verse 9 through 12. There is an example of a prayer that I have actually prayed for my family members at different times, Paul's very words, that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, to please him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all power, according to his glorious might, for the attaining of all steadfastness and patience, joyously giving thanks to the Father who's qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. Wow, that's quite a prayer. That's, for the record, Colossians 1, 9 through 12. This is a very rich prayer because lots of specific detail, a lot of particulars. Now, these aren't things. These are more spiritual particulars that are being prayed about there, but this is just one example. Just page before that, in Philippians, I think Philippians 4, here, yeah, the facing page in my Bible to what I just read, the passage I referred to earlier, be anxious for nothing, But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. So there's a pretty wide open thing. I sometimes think there's some prayers that are a little frivolous, but I've prayed them. I prayed for parking places. You know, maybe God cares, maybe he doesn't. I don't know. Ask. If you get a good one, you say thank you. You know, just have a thankful spirit. But most of the time, our prayers ought to be about things that are less frivolous, more weighty. Those are just the throwaways, moment by moment, day to day. So you're kind of communing with God as you're going along, and then you're late. You say, oh, please, Lord, let the light stay green. Let me get through there because I'm running behind. I do that all the time. But that isn't the bulk of my prayer, my supplication. My requests usually are weightier than that. And, you know. So,
yeah,
so I go ahead. Prayer is multifaceted, I guess, is what I want to say.
It is. And reading Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence,
right,
the monk, that seemed to me, when I read it, I'm like, I think that's like, that guy has a relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be, and prayer is more like a conversation. So it's not as simplistic as asking, thanking. It'd be like if I talk to you, we're talking about a bunch of different things. I thank you,
right.
I'm communicating with you, I'm asking you for something all at once. It's not as easy as, you know, I only call Greg to ask him a question.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I guess. I'm trying to chew it over in my mind as I'm talking.
Okay, no, this is good. But see, we're enjoying each other's company. We're talking on. And though the nature of the show is that you call for a reason, and that's how our interaction goes forth here for the sake of the radio. If you and I were just to sit down with each other and have a meal or something like that, just relax for an hour and chat, our conversation would range over a number of different things. And some things might be where you're gaining some information from me to your benefit. Other things might be just enjoying each other's reflections on something, you know, or sometimes you just sit quietly with people, you know, and just enjoy their company. It's really, the richer the relationship, the richer and the larger the variety of ways you interact. And I think this is true with God, too. I know that there are times when I'm driving, as I did an hour and a half to get to the studio today, given where I live, and I'm praying, but I notice that I start praying about something, and it's a request. I need help. I need insight. I need something to happen. I want the day to be productive. I want this month to be productive. There's a lot going on in our family, and for me professionally, I got lots of stuff on my plate. I start praying about that, and then I think about one thing on my plate, and then my mind gets running off into how I'm going to solve that problem, and then I have to call myself back to the particulars I was praying about. But in my mind, though, in all of those things, I am before the Lord. We are doing this kind of together, and I'm not inclined to say, and then God gave me this idea, that thought to me about doing this other thing. No, I'm not inclined to put it that way, but I'm with the Lord in all of that. And sometimes I'm just really enjoying the scenery. You know, I take a drive through Malibu Canyon. I jump across the mountain and go to the coast from where I live, and then go up the coast usually instead of fighting the 101 and the 405 in Sepulveda Canyon there, which is really a nightmare traffic-wise. I have a beautiful ride along the coast and through the hills where I can see coyotes and deer and stuff and do fairly regularly. But
the critters, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. But what am I doing? I am doing that with the Lord. I'm doing that with the Lord. That's the way it feels to me. It says in Ephesians, or rather, 1 Thessalonians 5, pray unceasingly, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. So what is that unceasing prayer? I mean, for a lot of times that mystified me, and I'm still not sure I have a good handle on it. But I think part of it means being with the Lord so much so that as things come up, you can comment to the Lord about these things the way you would if you were a companion with somebody else and you're going through these things together. Hey, look, there's a deer. Wow, look at that. Oh, man. Can you believe it? Or something. You know, you're just making small talk. But in this case, you're making small talk with God. It seems to me that that's part of it. Now, there are other times you get down to business, and I'm on my knees by the side of my bed. I don't usually pray kneeling because it's hard to kneel in my car. I'm driving is when I'm redeeming the time. Oh, there's our word again. I'm redeeming the time. This is from another call. Use of that word redeem. But sometimes I get down and I'm completely focused. And I'm trying to grab a hold of God, and I'm pleading with him for something. And that's also part of prayer. I was talking to a friend a couple of days ago who's actually on our board, but he came to me as a friend because he first came to Stand to Reason. And he told me that there was something that I said years ago that he listened to on the radio that really had a profound impact on him. And I'm thinking, okay, well, tell me this deep spiritual reflection that I offered to you. And he says, yeah, I listened to you once and you were talking about prayer, and then you just said it. What? Prayer is weird. And he said that one statement, three words, prayer is weird, three words, had a profound impact on me. Because I'm thinking prayer is weird, and I haven't figured it out yet. And then when I hear you say prayer is weird, it kind of helps to legitimize my own frustration or confusion or lack of understanding about prayer. And he said that really helped me a lot. So a little throwaway like prayer is weird helped him. But I'm just going to invoke it again. Prayer is weird. There's all kinds of weird aspects about it. What is the metric of prayer? Do you ever think about this, Aaron? What is the metric? Like how many prayer minutes do I have to log in order to qualify for the prayer answer on this issue? And
yeah.
If I pray half the time, but somebody else prays the same time, then it equals the same amount of prayer, you know, tokens. I don't know.
And I don't know either. It's like, this is a totally separate issue. But for me, I've heard stories of people's, you know, limbs growing back or people have these out-of-body experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of those people that's very charismatic, mm-hmm. or I have a hard time ever believing that I could see somebody's arm grow back, although I know that it happens in other countries, and mm-hmm. I believe what they're saying. I just don't know if I'll get to see it just because that's how I am.
Right.
And I've heard you comment before, some people are the prayer warriors, and God listens to those guys.
Yeah.
And
apparently,
you know,
we all have the same obligation, and some people seem to be more effective than others. But look at you. Then you read James, and it says, "Look, it says that Elijah was a man like we are. Like us. He was human with a nature like ours. But then he prayed, and then the storm came." I said, "Well, yeah. Well, I'm a man like Elijah, but I don't think the storm is going to come when I pray." You know?
No, I don't either.
So this is part of the mystery. You read those kinds of things. So here's my takeaway from this. I do have a recommendation, some book recommendations on this, but my own takeaway is, as I said earlier, prayer is weird. And so what you do is you do what the instructions say to do. You pray. You work at it. You make your requests known to God. You pour your heart out before God. I quoted something out of Psalm 60. Let me see if I can find it here. Psalm 62 a few moments ago, which I've been reading lately, and Psalm 63 and others in the vicinity. My soul waits in silence for God only. From him is my salvation. He is my rock. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not greatly be shaken. And I think, and I said this the other day, how are you my stronghold, God? I don't get it. So I'm reading this and I'm praying at the same time. What's up with this? I don't get it. Verse 5, my soul wait in silence for God only. There he goes again. My rock, my strength, my refuge is in God. Yeah, there you go. And then verse 8, trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. And I got a little insight then. Oh, he's a place of refuge for me in that I can go to him and pour out my heart before him. This is like completely affective. I'm upset. I'm confused. I'm frustrated. I pour out my heart before him. What is going on, God? I don't get this. So whatever it is, you're saying it. He is one you can go to and pour your heart out before whatever's there, you can tell him. Verse 8, there's Psalm 62. But that's one element of it. Philippians 4, be anxious for nothing, with everything, with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, make your request known. There's another element. My soul waits in silence. By the way, that's the beginning of Psalm 62, and then it says to pour out your heart. So sometimes you're silent. You're just struck dumb. I have nothing to say, God. I am so mad I can't speak right now, but I'm before you. I am so upset. I'm so confused. I'm so discouraged. I just wait in silence before you. I don't know what else. I've prayed out. So that's all part of it. When I say I'm prayed out, I mean I'm talked out regarding it.
Yeah.
There I am before him, so I'm still in prayer, if you follow me. So unlike what you experienced when you're growing up, prayer is not simply an occasion where we bow our heads and ask for something or say thanks. Although mealtimes is an appropriate time to say thanks for what you're about to receive. When I pray with my daughters, I have them offer one thing they give thanks for and one thing they're asking for somebody else. That's just a way of tutoring them a little bit. But as time goes on, it's going to be different. It's going to be as they grow up, they'll see these other dimensions of pouring out our heart, of wrestling with God like Jacob did, or even being silent before God, as the psalmist states. That's all part of it too. So,
Well, I think it's a different understanding than from God being a genie to God being, you know, like you said, like your parent.
Yeah, God. Yeah, well, parent in the sense that there's that kind of relationship there, but there's even more than that. And I keep in mind, too, that Aslan is not a tame lion. So our music is up. We have to end on this note. But just we're not going to be able to put God, we're not going to put a leash on him. But struggling with him in prayer of variety of sorts is the best way to learn about prayer. Okay, Aaron? Great talking to you. Thank you so much, and happy Christmas to you. All right, friends, good note to end on. And thank you for spending this time with me. I'm Greg Kokel. You go out and give them heaven this week, all right? And pray about it. Bye-bye, friends.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.